The Honorable Trevor Hammond has asked me to make a personal statement. I thank you, Mr. Speaker, for giving me leave to make this statement. My family suffered a terrible shock earlier this week when we received the news that my youngest son, Simon, had suffered an accident. He had fallen from the line wall adjacent to the Catholic Community Centre right down to Reclamation Road. A fall of some considerable height, but for the intervention of a tree and in all probability a guardian angel, the result of such a fall would have been grave. Indeed, most of the medical professionals who have subsequently encountered have been astonished how little damage he has sustained. But his injuries are no more than superficial, and for that we are all immensely grateful. But of course, our gratitude extends beyond our relief of his luck, and I come to my reason for having requested permission to make this statement. For once again, those who work in our emergency services have shown the fantastic degree of professionalism, but also of empathy that goes beyond the call of duty, for which I know all in this house are proud. My honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition, stood to make a statement earlier this year, praising the fire service after his dog had suffered a fall. I certainly hope this trend of falling from objects discontinues immediately. I, however, would like to cite our other emergency services, the Royal Gibraltar Police, for their swift investigation of the incident, and those who work in the GHO for the tremendous support that they have provided. In particular, I must mention a few in person who played a significant role over the last couple of days, though there are many, many more who have been involved in Simon's care, all vital cogs in the GHO who have ensured he has received the best possible care. The ambulance technicians, Alan Gavada and JJ, who stabilised Simon's condition and made sure he arrived safely at St. Bernard's. The initiative Richard Roberts, who kept us informed of Simon's condition while accident and emergency. The nurses, Antonio Munoz and Araceli Moreno, for the constant and attentive care they gave Simon while he was in the critical care unit. And to the surgeons, Dennis Kovacs and Thomas Berger, who kept us advised of Simon's progress and condition throughout and still do. I could mention many more, but that would require some considerable time. It is remarkable how many people it takes to properly treat one person. I salute the staff of the ambulance service, accident and emergency, the critical care unit, radiology and Rainbow Ward for their hard work and dedication. Our community is in good hands. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, can I just associate myself with the words of the Honourable Gentleman? It came as a shock to me last night when you told me that the Honourable Gentleman was going to make a statement from the reports that we had all read in the local media of the young man who had had the accident with the Honourable Gentleman's son. Speaker, the people that the Honourable Gentleman has highlighted for mention in the council, all the others who have not been able to mention because they are too many to figure out, are providing the service that he refers to every single day to many other members of our community, and we must thank them for that, not just in the case of the Honourable Gentleman's family, where he's right in contact to thank them for that purpose, but for the service that they give to all of the community every day. That's why, Mr. Speaker, we have to stand by the position of this government of investing in the public sector, of investing in our public services, and in particular, in investing in the Gibraltar Health Authority and in the Royal Gibraltar Police. And if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister, who was recently also afflicted by an illness and was able to experience the fantastic service that he provides as a minister when he does it, just like everybody else, but very well indeed. May I just say, on behalf of the many professionals who have been mentioned, the gratitude to the words that have been expressed both by the Honourable Member Opposite and by the Honourable Chief Minister. I'm glad to say I have seen the young man on two occasions already and he's recovering well. I was sadly also within the premises of ICU just about a week ago. Fortunately, this was nothing serious. I got excellent treatment too, and people were pulling my leg saying that I got that treatment because I was a minister. Clearly, I knew that wasn't the case, and clearly, this is confirmed. So, congratulations to all the professionals, not just in the GHA, but also in the Royal Gibraltar Police and other emergency services. We must never take them for granted, and I know that this house never does.
now proceed to government motions. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this House, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. This House recalls that the Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform reported to Parliament on January 2013. Note that the members of the Commission were the Honourable A.J. Gandiver, GMHOBE, MP, the Chairman, Mr. C. Gomez, the Honourable G. Mascarenhas, Mr. R. Vasquez QC, and the Honourable F. Vinet. Further note that the unanimously expressed view of the Commission that there is no need to establish a general purpose standing committee or a public accounts committee, given that opposition members have every opportunity to examine government expenditure in detail, as well as debating the report from the principal auditor on the government accounts for every financial year, and hereby endorses the view expressed by the Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform. Well, Mr. Speaker, the proceedings of the Commission on Democratic and Political Reform led to a wide and deep public consultation. This was a process that was begun shortly after the magnificent new dawn of the 9th of December 2011 saw the return to government of the DSSP, now in coalition with the Liberal Party for the first time since 1996. And we established the Commission on Democratic and Political Reform with, if I may say so, the expert chairmanship of yourself, given your 20 years experience in Parliament before you returned as Speaker, and with the other individuals that I have mentioned. I would like to say a little more about them. Mr. Charles Gomez and Mr. Robert Vasquez are both established lawyers in the jurisdiction. Mr. George Mascarenhas, I believe, was in Parliament just shy of the 20 years that you were in Parliament, so I think from 1976 to 1992, first with the Gibraltar Democratic Movement, then with the AACR. Speaker, and Mr. Fagan Burnett was a minister in the GSP government between 2003 and 2011, and much mystery still surrounds the failure of his selection in 2011 for standing as a candidate with the GSP in that ill-fated election for them. So, Mr. Speaker, that commission was hardly a commission made up of people who did not understand parliamentary procedure. As it turns out, Mr. Speaker, one of the members of that commission, Mr. Vasquez, subsequently decided that he would stop being an independent commentator and would join a political party, the DSP, and he subsequently stood for election at the last election in 2015, and he was not elected, and I understand he remains a member of the executive committee of the party primarily represented, obviously. I can no longer say it's unfortunate because one of the ladies, of course, is in the rocket chair at the end of the road on the right. But the party primarily represented the opposition is currently, and I hope for many years, led by the Honourable the leader of the opposition. Mr. Speaker, so we have a Commission on Democratic and Political Reform, which has set out in detail what the proposal for the reform of our democracy has been, which is set up after the general election of 2011, and which carries out a detailed consultation exercise with the general public. And apart from just publishing a report in January 2013, you also published the work in progress that we have, and which you consulted, and you received the communications from the public in respect of the issues upon which you were consulting. You subsequently published in January 2013 the report to which I have referred, which set out in great detail what your analysis and recommendations were. There were four parts to it. There was a minority report which dealt with issues relating to backbenchers, but did not deal at all with the issue of public accounts committee, which is the subject of this debate. That minority report was by Mr. Vasquez, QC, who is the person who I refer to now as being a member of the party primarily represented opposite, but it did not deal with the issue of a public accounts committee. So, Mr. Speaker, that is the position which is received in this Parliament. And there is then wide agreement in the Parliament that there are parts of the report on which we have set recommendations, which set up a select committee. In fact, by the time that the select committee had reported, a lot of the things which were at the same time as the issues dealt with by the select committee were our policy and the policies on which we fought the election were implemented, and I'm pleased to say, in large measure, by agreement. So we are televising the proceedings of this Parliament, which is one of the recommendations of the report, because we all agreed that it should be televised. We are holding monthly meetings of the Parliament, because it was our policy that that should be the case, where people call that the Commission felt that, in fact, monthly might be a little too often. And I set up, Mr. Speaker, a select committee in order to consider further parts of that report. Now, it's important that we consider, again, why it was that the select committee was set up. Historically, we must put this in context. The position of the government was that there were a lot of recommendations set out in your commission, which we would immediately accept and that we should proceed with, and that should be something we're ready to act immediately. But we were persuaded, Mr. Speaker, from the opposition benches, not to proceed to implement all the reforms which were accepted, but that we should proceed to set up a select committee. Now, Mr. Speaker, this was not done on the recommendation of an average Joe, and I don't mean to disrespect members opposite by suggesting that any of them might be an average Joe. But, Mr. Speaker, in fact, there are some Joes who are far from average, Mr. Speaker, far from average. This recommendation from the opposition benches, Mr. Speaker, came from the man who the current, and I hope in any way, leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker, has described, is not as the greatest libertarian of all time, certainly as the greatest libertarian of his time. Well, I mean, opinion, of course, is the figure divided as to how he was described. But in other words, Mr. Speaker, this is a proposal that came from the mouth of a man who the current leader of the opposition sees as a political god. And who, when he was speaking, so you could pretend to speak and say, he could chair as if he were a political god. So, quite foolishly, Mr. Speaker, the government, in a moment of extreme parliamentary conviviality, decided to accept that recommendation and set up a select committee. We did so, and as a result, it's not been possible to implement many more of the other reforms. I hope we will be able to change that, and I hope that the select committee, which we have re-established for the right hand of this parliament, will do as you have suggested, Mr. Speaker, and deal quickly with the issues that are before it. And we're not able to do so, Mr. Speaker, the government, not by lacking conviviality, but by wishing to progress. The democracy in which we live may simply have to act and make recommendations. But this is just a try to continue the possibility. But we have not been able to meet, Mr. Speaker, as much of the work of the Parliament has been delayed by consensus since the campaign and the referendum began, and unfortunately the wrong result is delivered, and of course that is taking up a lot of the time of the government, but there is another motion on that matter, and I will come to that in a moment. But in any event, we intend to propose reforms to the select committee, because I'm reminded, Mr. Speaker, by the Honourable the Deputy Prime Minister, that we set up the select committee on parliamentary reform and we set up the committee on the constitutional reform at a time when, in the heavy days, Mr. Speaker, when the opposition was united. But now that the opposition is divided and the Honourable Lady sits not with the whip of the DSD, it is our intention, of course, that she should be represented in respect of an important commission or select committee that is going to deal with reform of our democracy and, of course, in respect of the commission that will deal with the constitutional matters. So that is the state of play in respect of the report of the Commission on Democratic and Political Reform and the select committee that is being set up for the purposes of dealing with it. So, Mr. Speaker, given that it was from the opposition benches that we were encouraged not to proceed with the reforms set out by the committee as reforms that should proceed, so that we could in fact sit down and consider together what those issues were. Given that there is a minority report which is prepared by an individual who is a member. all of the executive committee of the party primarily represented opposition. And given that the report to Parliament on democratic and parliamentary reform actually states that we should not establish a public economic committee, and I'll come to that reason in a moment, imagine my surprise when I saw a motion coming not from the GOG opposition, in my view, that had represented to us that we should sit down and in committee deal with this issue. The self-same GOG opposition that is already represented in the select committee, because it was Ms. who is not currently represented in the select committee. Speaking that the House stood by resolution and motion to the opposite of what the Commission had recommended. Because I thought that a huge disrespect to the procedure established by the House for considering the Commission's report. I was surprised that honourable members who were the party who persuaded us to take into committee the recommendations of the Commission was now purporting to do something different in an area which was contrary to the report of the Commission and not referred to in the minority report of the executive member, and moved, Mr. Speaker, by a member of the opposition benches who'd been a member for a few months. An action against the recommendation of a commission chaired by you and including Mr. Mascarenhas and Mr. Binet to have a cumulative period in the Parliament just among you of approximately 44 years. You've been there for 20 years, you've been carrying on for 6 and you've been there for 8. So it is all of your experience and all of your work counted for nothing, and all of the government's conviviality and acceptance that we should deal with these matters in select committee were as nothing to the member who spent less than 6 months here. There was another meeting on the other paper that we seek to go entirely contrary to the recommendation of the committee. And so, Mr. Speaker, at that point, I believe I should thank you. Recommendation 3.8 on standing the committee, Mr. Speaker, sets out the following, and I'm going to read it in full. The 2.8 standing committee. We have considered whether there is a need for an increasing number of parliamentary standing committees and whether one of these should be a general corpus committee. The standing orders only make provision for one standing committee, i.e., a standing order committee, which of course is also established just after the election committee. We have also considered whether a public accounts committee should be reintroduced as it existed from 1990 to 1984. That committee was composed of 2 opposition members, one of whom was a chairman, and 3 government members. There have been varied views from respondents, but in their name there has been support for a public accounts committee, and there has been suggestions that such a committee should be chaired by a deputy speaker, and that that committee should form the backbone of the committee. We are of the view that the 1980-1984 public accounts committee proved ineffective, impracticable, and unworkable, particularly because ministers were expected to scrutinize the questions to the executives of their ministerial colleagues' departments. If a public accounts committee were to be set up, it would be essential for government backbenchers to take the place of ministers. We have concluded that there is no need to establish a general purpose standing committee nor a public accounts committee, given that the opposition members have every opportunity to examine government expenditure in detail, as well as debating the report from the principal auditor on the government accounts for every financial year. 2 things, Mr. Speaker, I think are important to highlight about that recommendation, or that lack of recommendation, because when you make a recommendation for action, you actually box it in and make a specific recommendation. Here you're saying there should be no accounts committee. First of all, There was a public accounts committee from 1980 to 1984. Both yourself and Mr. Nathaniel, who were members of the committee, were in Parliament between 1980 and 1984. So two out of the five members of the committee were speaking authoritatively as people who had parliamentary experience, one of 20 years, the other of 60 years, and had been members of this House when there was a public accounts committee. And another thing, Mr. Speaker, there is no member of the Commission that is a member of the Executive Committee of any of the political parties represented on this side of the House. So this is a totally independent committee of whom two members have lengthy parliamentary experience and of whom those two very members were also in the Parliament when the Public Accounts Committee was established in the history of our Parliament. So, Mr. Speaker, I think that the Commission has done the work of demonstrating through public consultation, through consideration, and through a lengthy Commission report, which will continue to be the basis upon which the Select Committee considers its work once it has been reconstituted with the Honourable Lady having the option to be a part of it. We therefore, Mr. Speaker, receive a suggestion that we should act contrary to the advice of the committee so established with all of the experience that the Honourable members that were part of it brought to it. Seems to me, Mr. Speaker, a huge disrespect to the work done by that committee, and the government cannot be persuaded to do anything other than entirely endorse the work that you have done and to accept the view set out by that independent commission that there is no need to establish a general purpose standard committee, nor a public accounts committee, given that opposition members have every opportunity to examine the government expenditure in detail, as well as debating the report of the principal auditor on the government accounts for every financial year, Mr. Speaker. And I remind members of it that not this year, but last year, in the debate on the estimate for the year 15-16, they almost asked no questions in the committee stage. There are plenty of opportunities to analyze every item of expenditure, but also this is not about disclosing more or disclosing less. It's about honourable members using the opportunities that they have and not pretending to come here to act contrary to the recommendations of an independent commission which has included members of the experience that I've referred to before. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, I commend that the House supports the motion.
I now propose the question and return for the motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. Any member wish to contribute to the debate? The Honourable Vice Clinton.
It is regrettable that the government has seen fit to bring this consummation in what the new people described quite simply as an attempt to hijack my prior motion for the creation of a public accounts committee. And Mr. Speaker, what is even more regrettable is that the government, rather than argue the merits or otherwise of having a public accounts committee, has sought to copy its homework by referring to the report of the Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform, of which, of course, you, Mr. Speaker, was the previous chair. The Commission reported in January 2013, after being appointed on the 2nd of March 2012, with wide terms of reference. Quote, requiring to report on all aspects of the parliamentary electoral system in Gibraltar and to make recommendations therein to Parliament. The final report was extensively debated in Parliament in June 2013. Recommendation by recommendation. At the conclusion of that debate, the following resolution is passed as follows. This House welcomes the work done by the Independent Commission on Better Taxing and Parliamentary Reform. Further welcomes that the Commission was able to report to the House ahead of schedule. Notes and welcome the Commission has made clear recommendations in proposing areas of reform for working with Parliament and for democratic reform. And having today debated and considered the recommendations of the report, will refer the said report to a select committee on the implementation recommendations of the Independent Committee on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform, and in brackets, to be known as the Select Committee on Parliamentary Reform, which is hereby established since the 3 members of Fonsborough Chief Minister, 2 of Fonsborough Leaders of the Opposition, to consider the implementation of appropriate recommendations of the report. Mr. Speaker, as you are aware, the Select Committee was reconstituted this year and has yet to meet, and has not, to my knowledge, issued any report in respect of the implementation of any appropriate recommendations. And, Mr. Speaker, it is at this stage that I need to point out that the view that is quoted by the Chief Minister in his motion is really not a view. It was not issued as a recommendation in the final report for consideration by Parliament. That view, it would appear, had already been arrived at by the Commission's members upon issuing the consultation documents, and thus before taking evidence on the utility of standing committees of Parliament. In the final issued report, the Commission stated as follows. I quote, there have been varied views and responses, but in the main, there has been support for a public accounts committee. The Commission, they went on to say, the exact opposite in the final report. Namely, we have concluded there's no need to set up a general purpose committee, nor a public accounts committee, given that opposition members have every opportunity to examine government expenditure in detail, as well as debating the report from principal auditor on the government's responsibility for the financial year. Alas, Mr. Speaker, in my opinion, the Commission erred in its view. The committee membership did not count on a single accountant. I was dominated by no doubt well-meaning lawyers with, alas, no experience in such matters. A public accounts committee as a select committee of Parliament serves a much wider role in scrutinising the use of public funds and in calling in witnesses and preparing reports for Parliament than merely engaging in political debate. It is an essential tool most parliamentary democracies understand. I have, in the armoury of checks and balances on the executive and public service, the mother of all parliaments in the United Kingdom has had a public accounts committee since 1857, and no one has suggested it is redundant. On the contrary, its remit has grown with the increase in complexity of public finance and procurement. Mr. Speaker, I took the liberty of discussing the usefulness of the last public accounts committee with its chairman, Major Frank Dunbiano, and he kindly allowed me to express his view that he was indeed useful. In fact, Major Dunbiano told me that the Director Hassan himself was entirely supportive of the public accounts committee because, to quote the Director, he had nothing to hide. I have also heard from a former senior civil servant who gave evidence to the Commission. He stated that it was important that heads of department felt that could be held accountable to Parliament if a public accounts committee existed. This would perhaps, Mr. Speaker, avoid the need for the Chief Minister to call in the heads of department on the 5th of December and read them the Riot Act as regards expenditure in the final quarter. But, Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister's motion is lazy, in that he is relying on an ill-considered view has not even been the subject of a recommendation to Parliament. And indeed, he contrasts the public opinion by commissioning his own admission. In my own motion, which I should add, proceeded the government's motion, I will argue a positive case for the Church of the Public Accounts based on reasoned arguments, modern practices, and the public good. I would ask the Chief Minister to indicate that I administer the free vote in this motion, as I would like to convene the Parliament with one to include its working rather than spiteful fallacies. And so, Mr. Speaker, I really have nothing further to say on the Chief Minister's motion, other than to ask this House to reject it as worded, and allow me, in my motion, to set up a positive case for the Church and the Public Accounts Committee for the public good. And finally, Mr. Speaker, I hereby give notice I will be calling for a division at the end of this debate to each member's position. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Any other honourable member wishes to give in the motion? The honourable gentleman of the opposition.
Mr. Speaker, yes, thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, I am certainly not going to respond to the honourable gentleman, the Chief Minister's barbed comments. I think that they are something that we should have left in the sixth form playground many, many years ago, and it is something that is, in fact, telling people away from politics, and it is not something that we should be bringing up to this House. And Mr. Speaker, I do think that the Honourable the Chief Minister's reason for supporting his motion, behind his motion, are both confused and indeed confusing. What he is effectively saying is that the Commission on Democratic Reform, chaired by Mr. Speaker, had a cumulative experience of 40 years between various individuals of parliamentary experience. And it would be, to quote him, a huge disrespect to the Commission, and in particular to those members, for the Honourable Mr. Clinton's motion on the Public Accounts Committee to be endorsed by this House. It is, quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, a ridiculous assertion to make. The Commission on Democratic Reform reported to Parliament for the specific purpose that Parliament considered its recommendation, and the select committee that was established precisely to consider what recommendations that were made in their report would be adopted by Parliament and which ones would be rejected. And effectively, what we're really saying, Mr. Speaker, is that the work of the Select Committee over the last 4 years, and I'll come back to the work in a moment, is a complete sham. Because we might as well, all of us, endorse the recommendations of the report produced by the Democratic Commission on Parliamentary Reform. It's absolutely ridiculous, Mr. Speaker. It runs a coach and horses through the entire purpose of the Select Committee. The reality was that that report was debated in 2013. If one looks at the debate in 2013, anybody who cares to look at it will see that different views were expressed, certainly on this side of the House, to different recommendations made by the committee in the report. Some were endorsed from this side of the House, some were rejected from this side of the House. And indeed, on this side of the House, we have always been supportive of a public accounts committee, Mr. Speaker. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, I won't criticize him for it, because everybody's entitled to change their view. But the Honourable Gentleman has referred to Mr. Burnett, who was a member of the government that I had the privilege and the pleasure to serve the people of Gibraltar between 2007 and 2011. Mr. Burnett stood in this House on a motion on parliamentary reform in 2011, endorsing the virtues in very passionate terms, it has to be said, of that benefit and the creation of that benefit. And Mr. Nett is one of the individuals in the commission that has effectively gone against his previous view, Mr. Speaker. I don't criticize him for it because everybody's entitled to change their view. But Mr. Speaker, what the Honourable Gentleman cannot do is come to this House and give the impression for all the world to see that effectively the report by the Commission on Democratic Reform was a fake accompli and that somehow, because we do not agree with one or two or three of its recommendations, that we are showing disrespect to the Commission or that we are somehow doing a vote back on our previous position, because nothing could be further from the truth. Mr. Speaker, indeed, the view that we express today on the Public Accounts Committee is the view that was expressed from this side of the House in 2013 and is a view that was expressed by some of us when we were in government, after the DOD, in 2011, when we debated a motion on parliamentary reform that was moved by the then Chief Minister, Peter Caruana, and his MEO. And Mr. Speaker, even if that were not so, even if we had not in 2011, or some of us, had not extolled the virtues of a public accounts committee, even if we had not extolled the virtues of a public accounts committee in 2013, what has happened between 2013 and today is that the Honourable Chief Minister and his government have retreated behind a person of secrecy, Mr. Speaker, in the management of our public finances, Mr. Speaker. Because they are not answering questions on the public finances of Gibraltar. So when, Mr. Speaker, the committee says that we can debate every single year the accounts and the estimates of this community, and that therefore we do not need a public accounts committee, well, of course, Mr. Speaker reported in 2013 that Credit Finance, the £320 million that was paid from the savings bank into Credit Finance, that was in 2013, post the report from the Commission. The huge debt that this community has incurred and has been saddled with by Honourable Gentlemen opposite, subsequent to 2013, which now stands at an eye-watering, Mr. Speaker, £1.1 billion, Mr. Speaker. £1.1 billion, and the Honourable Gentleman used to say in 2011 that the DOD was addicted to debt, Mr. Speaker, when it was less than half of that.
May I remind the Honourable that he was a position of the content of the motion and point out to him that under the guise of this motion, I am not going to allow Parliament to debate public debt. Will you please stick to the motion? You can make a reference, as an aside, which I take it as you have done. I take it that you have made a reference, as an aside, and therefore I allow you to do that, but not to debate public debt. If people are aware that this motion is in the Public Accounts Committee, that is a committee that is set up in order to examine the public finances of this community. Therefore, to disassociate. And the point that I'm making, Mr. Speaker, and with respect to Mr. Speaker, is a point. It does deal with the Public Accounts Committee. And the Public Accounts Committee, in general terms, it would be able to look into the question of public debt. But not the specific situation which we have in Gibraltar at the moment, and that is the issue. In general terms, yes, but not in specific terms now. Carry on.
You see, I don't want this to turn into, which unfortunately, on many other occasions, it has turned into, an exchange between the leader of the opposition and the Speaker, not, I have to say, in my respectful view of my own making. But, Mr. Speaker, The reality is that Mr. Speaker, that the committee that Mr. Speaker said was a committee that said, we do not want a public, or we do not recommend a public appeal committee, because one can debate, and thoroughly debate, and examine in detail the estimate, the estimate of accounts and expenditure for the government of divorce every single year. And the point that I'm making, Mr. Speaker, which is a point that I believe is well made and reasonable, is that that committee reported prior to the setting up of Credit Finance Company Limited, the position the government has taken on public debt. And that is the point. That today, more than ever, Mr. Speaker, today more than ever, because of the policy of the Honourable Gentleman opposite and the government that the Honourable Gentleman is chief minister leads, it is more necessary than ever to have a public accounts committee to scrutinise these issues, including the issue, Mr. Speaker, of effectively, for example, how many, what are the levels of tax reserves that the government has, which would then allow us to calculate net debt. That is the point that I was making, Mr. Speaker, and I believe that it is a point that is well made. But to summarise, Mr. Speaker, and conclude, the reason that the Honourable Gentleman has provided in support of his motion are confused and confusing. There is absolutely no mixture at all between our supporting a public accounts committee and any view or disrespect that we may have for Mr. Speaker's committee. In fact, that report was and has to be considered by the Select Committee. And of course, Mr. Speaker, I also remind the Honourable Chief Minister that I was about to turn to this particular point before Mr. Speaker interrupted me, that he controls the timetable for the Select Committee. The Select Committee has met only twice since 2013. So any implication, any implication or any suggestion that there has not been movement or a final decision on the recommendations from the Select Committee because of anything that the opposition has done is totally and utterly rejected, because he controls the timetable and he controls by when the Select Committee can report to the Senate. For all those reasons, Mr. Speaker, we will be voting against the motion, although I have to say that upon the invitation of my honourable friend, Mr. Clinton, I will be allowing members on this side of the House a free vote on this motion.
Does any other honourable member wish to contribute to the debate? The honourable Madeleine, something wrong?
Mr. Speaker, when the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Roy Clinton, just quoted my late father, it made me think, what do we have to hide? And why would we want to start the concept of any committee, public accounts, any committee which involves scrutinizing public spending? How could it be detrimental to have such a committee at a time like now, when we should be welcoming any and every platform to scrutinize public spending and public accounts? What do we have to hide?
I'll then call upon the Chief Minister to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I was sent to the end. Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing for exactly the same thing that the Honourable Gentleman has brought to the Honourable Lady's father into the debate. Exactly the same thing that the OECR had to hide between 1972 and 1980 when there wasn't such a committee, and between 1984 and 1988 where there wasn't such a committee. Because having had a committee only for one of the distinguished 40 years, or one term out of the distinguished 40 years, that the Honourable Professor Hassan was leader of this House and was predecessor, it is clear to me that it was absolutely right that although there might be absolutely nothing to hide, the committee added very little. And that is why the two people, Mr. Speaker, who were in the commission, who served with the Justice Hassan with distinction, yourself and Mr. Mascherini, actually recommended we shouldn't have such a committee. Because let's understand what we're talking about in the second such a committee. That is, in effect, to have a budget session every month. In a parliament where there are 10 ministers, and two of them are going to have to be in the parliament holding a budget session and bringing members of the civil service into this parliament to have a budget session with them every month. Now, your Liberal gentleman is a retired banker and accountant. He's got nothing else to do other than to try and grind the community to a halt in his government, asking for the price of PG chips and digest it. But Mr. Speaker, look, this parliament does not work at the Westminster Parliament. There aren't 650 of us here. And there are backbenchers here, Mr. Speaker. There are backbenchers here. And I will come to these two backbenchers and how it is relevant to this. So there is absolutely nothing to hide. That is why we want to put much more information online, and I'll come to that now, including information relating to net debt and gross debt and spending. Not to give it to the privileged few who in this parliament think that they should be entitled to things, so they can screw away and try and find the price of eggs, Mr. Speaker, but to the whole community, so that the whole community can see in real time where the debt is, or as close to real time as that may be possible, and I will come to that in a moment. But what was going to say? It's regrettable, coming to my response to Mr. Clinton, that I have hijacked his motion. Well, Mr. Speaker, look, what the Liberal government is never going to be able to get away with is the suggestion that he somehow trying to be collegiate and add to the way that our democracy works by putting a motion to create a committee of the House without picking up the phone and calling the Chief Minister who has the majority of the votes in the Parliament and saying, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? Look, I think it would add to the way that we do things in Parliament. If I were to put this motion, would you be prepared to support it? Or alternatively, would you suggest a motion in such terms which we could support? Well, in the time that he has been privileged to be a member of the House, although he has sent me back his tickets to the DMS under an envelope amusingly marked urgent parliamentary business, so I commend him for it, because I was able to give his tickets to somebody else, whilst the Liberal leader was missing, sent me a letter through his secretary and the letterhead of his law firm, which didn't arrive until Monday, and nobody took the benefit of those, or Tuesday, nobody took the benefit of those tickets. The only communication I had with him, and the letter now, which I think is going to be answered in relation to a question that came up in the context of the budget debate, and I've been traveling, so I haven't been able to give it a sense of work that I will. But if you're going to be bringing a motion, Mr. Speaker, and you want it to prosper, then look, you should ask the guy who leads the team that's got the most time to put up in the stand. Because I know that this is on the basis that politics is not a popularity contest, although that's how it was established in Athens more than two millennia ago. It's the people who get the most votes who get in, and with the most votes, they pass laws. But if they get over this idea, and they would like to form part of the process of change, and they want to persuade the government to come in, they should get a vote. I would have told him in this instance, Roy, read the report, and I would have called him Roy, and not the honourable gentleman over the phone. Read the report from the commission, which says the opposite. And Sir Joshua Hassan, who said he had nothing to hide, to Mr. Lillibian, by the way, didn't have a commission when he came back the following year in 1984, and he didn't have one between 1972 and 1980, and I assume, and entirely believe, that Sir Joshua had nothing to hide in those years either, or in the years before. It's not about hiding anything. But I will say one thing, Mr. Speaker, to the other gentleman. I continue to commend his reading of the newspaper. It is an excellent publication. It was wrong to ban it. It was wrong to ban it from number 6 to number 8. It was wrong not to send them press releases. It was wrong to keep the editor of the newspaper out of government press conferences. That is now being fixed. We didn't need the Commission on Parliamentary Reform to sweep away the attempt at secrecy and keeping from that inquisitive media of government information, and in fact, for the first 4 years that I was at number 6 for Montblanc, a copy of the front page of the first edition of the New People after the glorious new dawn of the 9th of December 2011, hung in my office, and I find it again, and made sure it's put back in the correct place to the other gentleman can see when he comes to meet me for extra parliamentary meetings. And Mr. Speaker, on the issue of a free vote, look, this is an issue that might come up again during the course of this meeting or the next meeting. I do not carry a whip hand in the way that I do politics. And I note that the highly experienced Rosie Winterton, who has been chief whip of the Labour Party, through many leaders from the time of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, has recently, this morning, been announced not to be chief whip anymore, and the result of the ongoing reshuffle that Mr. Corbyn is carrying out. But look, on this side of the house, the other members can see in their single portfolios, no one is a whip. No one is a whip. I do not whip my people, or indeed, the other people that are people, I mean, the liberals might get up to that sort of thing in private, but I certainly never seen it happen in the privacy of the cabinet office, Mr. Speaker. People here always are encouraged to vote their consciences. We come here with a position that we think is right for the community. We come here with a view that we've arrived at together in consensus. Nobody here has been told to vote one way or vote the other, because I would not have the function to tell somebody not to vote their conscience. So I'm going to tell him that all of the defeats that he has suffered in the past 6 months when he has put motions since he was elected, and he will continue to suffer if he continues to put motions in a way that are not going to be agreed between us. Well, those are all not inflicted by a conniving Picardo whipping the other nine to support him in a particular way. This is the same opposition not voting with him of their own motion and in full conscience of what they are doing. But I also noted that the Honourable Gentleman stood up and delivered the speeches he had written in response to my motion and ignored much of what I had said, because he said, for example, it is the committee has yet to meet. I had explained why the committee had yet to meet. The committee has not issued a report yet. Of course it hasn't, because it hasn't met for the reason that I had explained. He thought he would just read his speech. But perhaps when he's a little more experienced in parliamentary terms, and despite the fact that he's an accountant and not a lawyer, he may be able to get up and deal with issues as they arise in debate, and not necessarily rise up in the speeches that he has written. You can see that the Honourable Gentleman then went on to denigrate the work of the commission by suggesting that he hasn't taken sufficient view of what the public believes, or sufficient cognizance of what the public believes, in making your view clear that there shouldn't be a public assembly. And he said, and one of them said, there's no recommendation, it's just the view. Well, it's because when there is a recommendation to do something, it is in a box. When they take a view in the commission that something should not be done, they just express it in that way. And that is their recommendation on that subject. The fact is that whether they are accountants or lawyers, and there were three lawyers and no accountants, there were two members of that commission, which I will not tire of telling him, were Bruce Pedrosa, who had nothing to hide when he had a commission, an accounts committee, and when he didn't have a public accounts committee, and he was in this house for the period when there was a committee, and they took the view that there shouldn't be a committee. So I think they are much better qualified, Mr. Speaker, to give a recommendation than somebody who simply has an accountant's qualification. You're dealing with people who were in this parliament for 4 years and are able to say, look, we believe that there is no need for the committee, although we have nothing to hide. Because we are going to assume for one moment that the job had nothing to hide, but that Mr. McCain was here, or indeed that Mr. Kennedy. Yes. Of course not. Nobody had anything to hide, but there was still a view taken rightly, despite the absence of accounting qualification,
that it was not the best way to spend the time of this house. So, Mr. Speaker, I am a few of Barb's comments when I say something slightly political, and yet I am exposed to allegations of laziness. Now, the figure of opinions of me may be divided on many subjects, and I'm sure that they are. Because the minute you win an election, people rightly take a view about things in politics, and you don't divide opinion, good luck to you, you're never going to get anywhere. I divide opinion. That's fine. I'm up for that. But I don't think anybody could be reasonably formulated. And so to say that I am bringing a lazy motion when I'm spending already over an hour of government time debating a motion in this parliament and preparing for it, and then be accused that I am the one who brings Barb's comments into the debate, and that I do this on a fixed form basis, and if somebody's obviously spent quite a few hours thinking of a phrase that's confused and confusing that doesn't otherwise roll off his tongue unless he thinks about it and spends time writing it down to read it out to the House, is really quite a joke. And that's to embrace both the attitude of the Honourable Mr. Clinton and the attitude of Mr. Peterson. But look, Mr. Speaker, let me tell them what is confused and confusing. The Honourable Gentleman says the Commission has done the wrong thing. The Commission has done the wrong thing. Because the public has told you that they would like to see a Public Accounts Committee. And you have recommended that there shouldn't be one. Well, for good reason, because none of those members of the public are likely to have been in this Parliament when it was the House of Assembly between 1980 and 1984, when two members of the Commission were members, and that's where they make the recommendation. But how confused and confusing that you want the Commission to follow the public's view on this subject, and yet on the other subject, where the members opposite represented in the GSB take a contrary view, the public's view, which is basically offensive, on page 13 of the Commission report, the last sentence, the majority of respondents are also opposed to any increase in the size of the Parliament, as the electorate is well served by 17 elected members and the additional expenditure is unwarranted. So they want you, Mr. Speaker, to follow the view of the public when it accords to them, and they say that they really can't understand why you don't take the view. And yet, when you do follow the views of the public, which is to say the public don't want backbenches, the Commission report that they should not be backbenches, there, they want you to go against the views of the public. Confused and confusing, Mr. Speaker. Confused and confusing. Sorry that that might sound like the sixth form, but I think the whole community is going to be in the sixth form trying to work out what it is that the Honourable Members want. They position themselves with the public when they think it suits them, and they position themselves against the public when they think it suits them. Confused and confusing, Mr. Speaker. Confused and confusing. Anyway, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Peter, when he gets up on the current leader of the opposition, says that I said he represented with Mr. Mascarenhas and Mr. Vinette about 40 years of experience. So, to figure, I think actually he misquotes me even in that respect. The arithmetic I think I referred to was 44. The experience represented by members of the Commission who had been parliamentarians for 44 years. In fact, Mr. Speaker, that is an experience contained in no ordinary Joe, Joe the Sun, who has had himself 44 years on his own of experience of the Parliament. Of course, Mr. Speaker, as I opened for the House, I can never forget that. If he got in 1972, and I got out in 1972, namely, I got out and I was born in 1976. So I always remember how many years he's been here. I can't refer to what I got out of Mr. Speaker, because it was one time in the year. But it is really, frankly, important for the House to reflect on the fact that a member with 20 years' experience herself, a member with 60 years' experience in Australia, both of the members were at the time that the House had a Public Accounts Committee and had nothing to hide. And Mr. Vinette, who was a member of this House for 8 years, and Mr. Bofana, who was a member of the House for 44 years and counting, for Mr. Cameron, who said to say, and the council where I'm from,
all are against the establishment of the Public Affairs Committee. And all the members agree with what he said in the quotes from Mr. Viviani about what Mr. Viviani said, though the first time he's no longer with us, said, for the speaker, I know he's an accountant and he's not a lawyer. But that statement offends the rule against double hearsay. So if he doesn't mind, I'm going to rely on the statement put in black upon white by the Independent Commission and the advice of the defense. Mr. Speaker, then Mr. Speaker says that the Select Committee has established a report to the Parliament and it hasn't yet reported to the Parliament, and that the Commission has reported to the Parliament and that it will be debated in the Parliament. Yet, when the Commission reported to the Parliament, the Commission did not envision that we were going to set up a Select Committee to consider its report. It cannot have, because nobody envisaged it, and in fact it was in the antechamber that the greatest libertarian of his or all time approached me and suggested that we could have a Select Committee. We considered it, and in that moment of conviviality decided to do it. And we should have just dealt with the parliamentary report, the report to Parliament, in Parliament. We could have just dealt with it then. And then there would be no need for a Select Committee to meet. Of course it would be critical for a Select Committee to meet, because we need to find time for it, etc. Well, it will meet, Mr. Speaker, because we've now determined to go down that road. But I remind you of the gentleman who on occasion he wasn't able to meet because of his dire commitment. And we went ahead without him on one occasion. On one occasion we went ahead without him, but another occasion we were unable to meet because of his dire commitment. The other gentleman says, of course, as you would expect him, because there's another confusing aspect of what members of the Honourable Lady do, is that they say, we don't want to talk about history, we just want to look forward. Why are you looking at history? But then they refer us to history when it suits them. And so the Honourable Government's reference to history is to say that the GC has always been in favour of a public accounts committee, always been in favour. Well, an ex-member of the GC in this Parliament, is no longer in favour. He might have been in favour before, but that was before he heard all the evidence and put it in the commission. A current member of the GSB executive was against, in fact, I think maybe the chairman of the GSB, Mr. Vasquez, maybe the chairman of the GSB, as I understand it. He was, and the candidate of the election, he was against a public accounts committee when the recommendation was made. Because that, the only thing that may have all passed. I'm not going to talk about people who are not here to defend themselves. I'm just expressing the position that they express. Whether it's a vote pass or not is another matter. I'm not going to express a view in respect to people who are not here to defend themselves or to put that in. They do need to defend themselves. But honourable members were in government between 1996 and 2011. There's a lot of whipping down. I still have the stars in my back. A lot of whipping down. That would have been parliamentary reform. In the moment, in the way things were done, there was no reason from the reality in this parliament and select committees established. It was then the rule of the rod from St. Peter's Square. People wrote the select committee that we were able to attend meetings of between 1996 and 2011. That full steam and constant support? Or is it that we have to judge the absence of a select committee between 1996 and 2011 as something to hide? Whether the honourable members apply a measure to themselves and a measure to others? So, if there isn't a vote pass, there must at least be a difference of opinion, which I suppose is the proper way of explaining it, Mr. Speaker. Because when they were in government, they did one thing, and the minute they're out of government, they start recommending another. And then we have this attempt, Mr. Speaker, to turn the debate to the question of the certain and secrecy and the debate so that, if you think on that issue, you rightly say, this is not what this motion is about. But honourable members are from margin, we are from Venus. A self-representative vote in public management is stronger than ever. We've already explained our position on the debt. Alderman is supposed to pretend to the public that we're not being confirmed. They're going to find it very difficult, Mr. Speaker. Because what we are saying is, we will continue to give you everything you've always had. We will continue to give you everything you gave when you were in government. What we will not give you, because we cannot be sure of the accuracy, and then if we give it to you, you're going to then come back at us, is the management of council on a day-to-day basis more accelerated than ever before. That's what's not going to happen. It's not an attempt at secrecy. This is an attempt at accuracy and at then transmitting information further than just in this parliament to the whole community. Now, I know that the Honourable Member thinks that they should be serious and have information here, and they can just pass it to them. They didn't think it's appropriate. They want us to go and fetch them for them and bring them and put them at their feet here. But some of them, we believe in openness and transparency to the whole community. That's why we're going to give more information than they gave on debt and net debt and gross debt. But we're going to give it online.
Yeah, I also ask this to give us a few minutes of interest and I'm interested in the public. No,
I can't believe in this. I won't argue like with you as a political leader with this because every time that you rule against it. And so, Speaker, that issue, which I no doubt we will be able to debate in the study of some of the other motions that are in the order paper or in the time comes, is irrelevant to this. But the question is an attempt to hijack this debate for that purpose, which is, if I'm mistaken, the certain to speak a rightly spotted and brought us both back onto the stage and now. But, Mr. Speaker, the one thing the Honourable Gentleman did say, which I'm just going to reply to him on, is when he said, of course, the recommendation of the Commission was before credit finance. Now we need this because credit finance has been set up. Well, look, Mr. Speaker, credit finance has been set up. It's got nothing to do with the public account of Gibraltar. It's got to do with the savings bank. This is even more off-tangent than the Honourable Gentleman was saying before. But he just wants to make it all about that, despite having suffered a crushing election defeat, having staked all his eggs in that basket before. Because credit finance wouldn't come within the purview of a public account committee. It's a figure of the savings bank. It is not a company that would come within the purview of the public account committee. Which is their complaint, Mr. Speaker. It's their complaint. So how can they pretend to fix the malaise that they say is there with something that is aiming in a completely different direction? It doesn't make absolutely any sense. But they, members opposite, say that all of that attempt to row contrary to the conclusion of the Commission on Parliamentary and Democratic Reform is not to disrespect its findings. Well, Mr. Speaker, to recommend the complete opposite of what the Commission has proposed. But to try and side with some members of the public, we don't know how many, on that, and to also try and go completely contrary to the view expressed by the Commission, absent the minority report on the other issue, despite the public being on the same side as the Commission, is to do a vote back on where the Commission should be, whether it should just be with the public or not, is to disrespect the Commission, and it's frankly, Mr. Speaker, an attempt to just bring to this Parliament issues to try and raise the specter of a lack of transparency in respect of a government which is more transparent than any government in history has ever been, because technology avails us of opportunities to do so, that puts more information of the sort that would be before the Public Accounts Committee online every day. For example, travel expenses and any other expense, where before hundreds of questions had to be asked orally in this house to get that information, and which information is now there for every member of the public to see, not just members of it. For all of those reasons, Mr. Speaker, I commend the motion to the House as it stands on the order paper. And I don't mind telling the Honourable Gentleman that, of course, that means that we will not be supporting the motion, which is being embraced. And I suggest to him that he should consider that this is the debate that we would have had in respect of that motion, and that he may wish simply to save parliamentary time and proceed now to seek to garner sufficient votes now that the debate is over.
We'll see how people vote. And as you see, President Biden managed to persuade any of the members on this side of the House who will vote their conscience freely on the subject that he has referred to in the context of this debate and on the subject of this motion. He may want to abandon his motion when it comes later on, because we're just going to be arguing exactly the same thing over and over again and reaching the same conclusion.
I now put the question in the sense of the motion proposed by the Honourable Chief Minister. On the clerk will now call the division as requested.
PJ Ralvan. JJ Rosano. Aaron Clinton. Joey E. Cortez. Anna Costa.
Aye.
D.A. Peterson.
Aye.
J.J. Garcia. Yes. T.M. Hammond.
No.
M.D. Hassan Naon.
No.
A.J. Isla.
Aye.
Gilead Nicole.
Yes.
S.P. Linares.
Yes.
Alex Yaman.
No.
E.J. Phillips.
No.
F.R. Pisadero. E.J. Taylor.
Nay.
S.J. Sacramento.
Yes. There are 10 votes in favor of the motion, 7 against the motion is carried.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
I have the honor to move the motion standing in my name, which means as follows. This House regrets that the outcome of the referendum of the 23rd of June in 2016 on whether the United Kingdom and Gibraltar should remain in the European Union should leave resulted in an overall decision to leave. Note the statement made by the United Kingdom government that Gibraltar will be fully involved in the formulation of the United Kingdom's policy in relation to a potential withdrawal from the European Union, known as a Brexit. Welcome to the declared intention of the government in a position to cooperate in determining both the impact on Gibraltar, the potential withdrawal from the European Union, and Gibraltar's future relationship with the European Union, and considers that the formal structure to take this cooperation forward should be a select committee of the House, which will be known as the Select Committee on the European Union. Believes that the composition of the Select Committee should reflect the composition of the House, and hereby resolves the establishment of a Select Committee to report to the House on these matters, consisting of 4 members nominated by the Chief Minister, 2 members nominated by the Leader of the Opposition, and the Independent Member of Parliament. Mr. Speaker, it's now over 100 days since the morning of the 24th of June, when the Gibraltar and the rest of the United Kingdom, Europe, and the world heard the results of the view of the British people that the United Kingdom should leave the European Union. In that time, honourable members will know that the government has been engaged in a lot of work of lobbying, in a lot of work of preparing the public sector and private sector for the purposes of providing all of the information necessary to the United Kingdom in the context of the negotiation that will take place when Article 50 of the Lisbon Agreement of Treaty is triggered. The Prime Minister, honourable members will know, has indicated in her speech to her party, not to the Parliament, that it is her intention to trigger Article 50 by the end of March the latest. Mr. Speaker, it is also true that in the United Kingdom Parliament, a similar mechanism for the understanding by Parliament of the work being done by the executive on Brexit is to be adopted, and the Select Committee is to be established to deal
I said, a platform with Hillary Benn of the Labour Party, who is seeking to be appointed as he confirmed that that new statesman fringe event around the Labour Party event in Liverpool, the Labour Party conference event in Liverpool some weeks ago. He's seeking to be appointed the chairman of that select committee. It's not clear yet the speaker wishes the party to have the chairmanship of the committee, but Mr. Benn is seeking it to be over channeled to him. It's also true, Mr. Speaker, that similar committees have been set up in other parliaments, including the Scottish Parliament, Mr. Speaker, as the mechanism for cooperation between the parliamentarians represented there and with the executive. The Scottish Parliament, so the committee understand has already been set up, the Westminster Parliament, so the committee is to be set up. Mr. Speaker, in the run up to, or in the moment after the referendum results, I have been speaking to a meeting with the leader of the opposition. On one occasion, when I was briefing him on the meetings we'd had in the United Kingdom, he, in fact, in writing, had proposed a select committee, which I reflected to him in the context of our discussion, was actually the position that had been proposed to me already by the Deputy Chief Minister and was therefore agreeable to the government. This is a motion that, as a result, I put before the Parliament some time ago. This is the first opportunity for taking motions, and therefore, Mr. Speaker, I look forward to having the full support of the House for the establishment of this committee, which will, I hope, give us the opportunity of working together at a parliamentary level and reflecting there the work that we as a government and as an executive will have done and will be dealing with now going forward in respect of Brexit. Mr. Speaker, there has been an exchange of press releases on the subject of Brexit in the past few days. I would rather leave those issues outside of this debate, because we're dealing here with establishing a committee for the purposes of being able to work together. If there have been disagreements in that respect, look, I think it is important that, that we start this work and we start to do it together in the context of the select committee. And perhaps in the select committee, the honourable members may wish to put some of their concerns about how the committee should work. But we have to be clear that Gibraltar does not have and does not need a government of national unity. And therefore, the government is governing, the government continues to control the executive, and will continue, therefore, to lead on the Brexit strategy, although it wishes to be able to work with the opposition in the context of the select committee. And the government will take the blame, Mr. Speaker, for anything that goes wrong as a result of the Brexit negotiations that we lead, and we will still be the responsibility of where that leads Gibraltar, because we are in government. Similarly, Mr. Speaker, we will take the credit of anything that we do in the context of that process, which takes Gibraltar to a better place. Now, Mr. Speaker, let me be clear. That is not to say that we are confident that Gibraltar is going to do it good now, whereas Brexit presents a lot of challenges for a lot of areas of this community. We have to do our best to achieve the best for each of those sectors, as would be the case for the United Kingdom and its many industrial sectors, and the case for most of the member states of the European Union that have a relationship with the United Kingdom. And if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, I think the best way to paraphrase what the Prime Minister has been saying in the context of our party's annual conference in Birmingham, which I was privileged to attend to represent the government last Sunday, and had massive support from members of the Conservative Party, as we have in the Labour Party and the Liberal Party, and no doubt we have also at the SNP with the Honourable Deputy Minister, the leader delegation next week. What he has been saying there in respect of Brexit and what he has been saying there in respect of the party's policy for the country, I think can be synthesized into a phrase that could represent both those aspects of the Prime Minister's policy and which would reflect our policies going forward and those of all the devolved parliaments and the Crown dependencies, namely that we need to find a Brexit that works for everybody. And Mr. Speaker, that is the work on which we are engaged and will continue to be engaged. It is true to say that it is taking a lot of government time, and as a result,
whatever decision is there, and I have been unable to give the full attention that we might have wished to give to other areas of government, but we expect to be able to continue to turn our attention to those. The government will be disappointed to know that we expect to be able to comply entirely with all manifesto commitments and deal for Brexit. And, Mr. Speaker, the one thing that I think is important is I explain why the composition would be 4-2-1. In the context of select committees, the government will have always an inbuilt majority. And, Mr. Speaker, in order to ensure that the committee stays nimble and small enough, the only way that we would be able to have an inbuilt majority, if it were bigger, would be to have 5 members of the government, 3 members of the opposition, and the Honourable Lady, because we think the Honourable Lady, as an independent parliamentarian, should be represented in the select committee. That would mean, Mr. Speaker, that the Parliament would be meeting with almost half its members in select committee. It would be 8 of us. So in order to keep it nimble and flying with the numbers opposite, the only way that we can do it is to do 3 and therefore 4 on our side, if the other lady is going to be 1 on the other side. Of course, Mr. Speaker, the other way to do it is to keep it 3 on our side, the Honourable Lady, and just 1 of the members representing the party opposite. We thought that would be less representative, so that's why we are proposing 4-2-1 to keep it nimble in that way. Mr. Speaker, I would propose that this select committee should meet with regularity in order to ensure that we are able to give members opposite the sort of information and have the exchanges that they think they should have. And we think it should meet in camera. In other words, we don't think it should be a select committee that should meet in public, although it should be a select committee that should be able to make public such information as the committee considers appropriate. Mr. Speaker, I think that with those remarks, I have dealt with all sorts of communication which we received from the deputy leader of the GOC, Mr. Hammond, in respect of this committee, and I hope that that will enable members of it to better understand how we propose that the committee should work. As I say, Mr. Speaker, I could simply now deal with all of the remarks that have been contained in the press releases from members opposite, which have been the subject of exchanges between the government and the opposition, but I call on members opposite to leave the public exchanges outside of the consideration of the establishment of this important committee of this House, where we will be able to cooperate and work together as a parliament to deal with the parliamentary aspects of what Brexit may mean for our community. I encourage them to do that and to work with us on the subject and not to allow this debate to simply descend into an exchange of press release, to use the word that the opposition used a few moments ago, press release vibe. And I invite the Honourable Gentleman to support the motion establishing the select committee so that we can move in the composition that I proposed as soon as possible during the course of this month and then continue to have regular monthly meetings and such other meetings as we may consider that may be appropriate, and even to invite members of the public to provide information to the committee in the context of such consultation as the committee may agree at its first meeting we should do. And I also invite the Honourable Lady for the establishment of the committee for the purpose that I propose. I think I detected in her earlier speech in respect of the other committee proposed that she thought there could be more committees. So this is an opportunity to see that part of her statement which come through, because I think without the need for flagellation, all 10 members in this side are likely to be supporting the committee.
I now propose the question in terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. Does any Honourable Member wish to contribute to the motion? The Honourable Chair Hammond. Mr. Speaker, it is indeed over 100 days since the referendum that saw us in the United Kingdom supposed to leave the European Union, and it is regrettable that this motion is only now being heard.
I believe there has been ample opportunity at specific meetings of Parliament to suspend orders, and have heard this motion. The trigger of Article 50, as the Chief Minister has said, will occur, according to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, next March, which means we've already lost a third of the time that would have been available to us to deal with these issues. I think that is regrettable. We nevertheless do welcome that this motion has now been tabled. And it is the intention of those in this House representing the Majesty's opposition to do all that we can to work with government, to assist government in navigating the challenges ahead brought about by the decision made by the people of the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. We fully recognise how significant, indeed existential, as the Chief Minister has put it, this process will be for the economy of this community. As it presently exists, and we stand willing to play a part, whatever part we are permitted to play by government. There are elements within this motion that we fully endorse. We share government's regret that the outcome of the referendum on whether the United Kingdom and Gibraltar should remain in the European Union or should leave resulted in an overall decision to leave. We welcome that the United Kingdom government has stated that Gibraltar will be fully involved in the formulation of the United Kingdom's policy in relation to a potential withdrawal from Europe, a policy that seems increasingly inevitable. Of course, a note of caution here is necessary, as fully involved does not mean that Gibraltar will be influential in the outcome of that policy, and indeed could be interpreted in many ways. Just as Her Majesty's opposition here in Gibraltar, through the formation of this select committee, might be considered to be fully involved in determining both the impact of a withdrawal by Gibraltar from the European Union and our future relationship with the European Union, as stated in this motion. Our actual influence, when the composition of the committee is considered, will be negligible. We might be fully involved, but it does not mean that we can necessarily influence the outcome of any decisions taken by the committee or affect government policy in this regard, should government choose to follow its own path. In the same way, that Gibraltar will not be able to influence the United Kingdom government should it choose to follow its own path, despite being fully involved in the process. Let us maintain a sense of reality and not hang our hats on such phrases. The motion fails to set out terms of reference for the Select Committee in anything but the religious terms. It sets out that the Select Committee is to report to this House on matters involving both the impact of a withdrawal by Gibraltar from the European Union and our future relationship with the European Union. Implicit in this wording is that the Select Committee will play a passive role, reporting on events rather than being actively involved in those events. Time will tell how effective and influential the role of this Select Committee will be or is allowed to be by government. The length of time that it has taken to bring this matter to the House is a disappointment, as I said earlier. The matter is one of some urgency, even considering that the declaration of Article 50 by the United Kingdom has not yet been made, though will be made next March, according to the Prime Minister. And of course, as I said earlier, it means we have effectively lost one third of the time that would have been available to us in order to deal with this issue. The urgency is clear from the fact that the government, and in particular the Chief Minister, has rightly been working to develop these strategies to try and navigate the inevitable challenges that will be faced. Some of this work has been public, and we have become aware of it through local and international press announcements. That this Select Committee has not been established with the same degree of urgency reaffirms the view that government does not intend to be steered by the committee, but to report to the committee. It is yet to be seen how such reporting will function, but those on the committee, including members of the opposition, will certainly not be providing direction to government. Had that been the purpose, this committee would surely have been established some months ago and in time to do so. And the Chief Minister has, to some extent, explained further the functioning of the committee and certainly the fact that it will meet in camera. But I do welcome the fact that those meetings, despite being in camera, information that's made available will be subsequently made available to the public and again understand it. And ultimately, the absence of clear terms of reference within the motion
and the potential lack of influence that the select committee will have, and certainly that members of Her Majesty's opposition will have, over determining policy in this area, does not and will not deter us from doing our duty, as we see it, to the people of Gibraltar. Despite being invited to participate in a process about which we have been told relatively little, rather like being invited to play a game but not being told what the rules are, or even indeed what game is being played, we would be voting in favour of this motion. We will continue to strive to work with government through this select committee as the mechanism chosen by this House to permit that cooperation and demonstrate to the governments of both the United Kingdom and the Kingdom of Spain that when Gibraltar is presented with an existential threat, there is no question of division either among its political classes or its people.
Any other honourable member? The honourable leader of the opposition?
Mr. Speaker, very briefly, Mr. Speaker, as my honourable friend, Mr. Hammond, has said, the opposition certainly welcomes the creation of the select committee. The select committee was suggested by the opposition in a letter that I wrote to the Chief Minister several months ago. It would have been our preference, Mr. Speaker, for the select committee to have been the vehicle whereby the government and the opposition make joint decisions and develop a joint strategy in relation to how we deal with the question of Brexit. That is what my friend Mr. Hammond means when he talks about terms of reference. Our understanding of the situation, and I'm not criticising the Honourable Gentleman for it, because at the end of the day, he is quite right. The government governs, the opposition opposes, and he is perfectly entitled to come to this House to seek the creation of a select committee, whereby the select committee would be the vehicle whereby the government effectively keeps the select committee and members of the members on this side of the House informed of decisions that the government has already taken. And it's up to the government, and I certainly don't criticize it. Our preference, of course, would have been for the select committee to have been that vehicle for the government and the opposition to be working towards that joint strategy and that joint response. But there's no appeal the government is going to be using the select committee for, and I think that it is important, Mr. Speaker, in the absence of those terms of reference, that ought to be emphasised in this House, that we're all clear exactly what it is that this select committee is being used for. Mr. Speaker, certainly the opposition is not going to be found wanting. Every time the government comes to the opposition and seeks the opposition's assistance, or the opposition's advice, or the opposition's counsel in relation to any initiative that the government is bringing to bear in relation to the to Brexit, we will be providing that counsel, that advice, in confidence, obviously, because that is the way that the select committee is going to be operating, in camera to the government, in good faith always, if we can support any initiative, and indeed, we will attempt to bend over backwards to support initiatives from the government. Obviously, we hope that it will never become necessary for us to take a strong different view to the government. At the end of the day, that cannot be ruled out because that is how politics operates. And to use the Chief Minister's phrase again, in quoting, government governs and the opposition opposes. But everything that we will do in good faith, and certainly the community will not find the opposition wanting in its participation in relation to the select committee, to whatever degree the Chief Minister wants us to participate.
The Honourable Member, I'm going to speak to you again. I'll call you.
Mr. Speaker, I think with respect, the Honourable Member, Mr. Trevor Hammond, and the Leader of the Opposition have attained some level of pertinence towards the perception of the committee and the management of government in handling the issue of Brexit. The fact is that the government has done well to set up a committee at this delicate time. While working right now is on all we have, which is speculation. I do accept and respect that in the last few months and over the sleepy summer break, the CM has had bigger fish to fry. And in this one, I have to say that the GSP, to the GSP opposition and the House in general, that Brexit is too important to make this a partisan battleground in the press or beyond. And this issue is just way too partisan delicate. We have to do Brexit together, so I welcome the Select Committee and embrace it for my inclusion. Thank you.
Another member, and we're going to call upon the Chief Minister for the Black.
Mr. Speaker, I intend to try and deal with the issues that have been raised in a way that is as constructive as possible, but I must say that I don't think that we are dealing with this, the establishment of this Select Committee late in the day and having a lot of further time available, because the figure of time available is not the time between now and the triggering of Article 50, which may or may not be by the end of March, it may be earlier, could have been already. Other members know that the position of the former Prime Minister, Mr. Cameron, was that Article 50 was happening triggered immediately after a result. He took the view that he should resign the morning after the result because he could not steer the United Kingdom through a Brexit with which he did not agree, and therefore that did not happen. The position of some members of the Conservative Party continues to be the Article 15 from the beginning as soon as possible, and the Prime Minister has now given an indication, not in Parliament, but in a party context, of when he thinks it's likely that Article 50 would be triggered. All that happens under Article 50 is that a letter is sent from the United Kingdom to the President of the Council and the President of the Commission, indicating that trigger is pressed, and it will contain the issues for negotiation, but Mr. Speaker, of course, it will not be exhausted. And so, can I just persuade honourable members to view the process as one of these things continue? It is not a select committee that will have to do its work by the 31st of March or earlier by the time that the Article 50 letter goes. This work will endure, and it will endure likely even beyond the 2-year initial period, if the negotiation is extended beyond that, or potentially even further while Brexit continues. And I dare say, Mr. Speaker, it's very likely that whoever is entrusted with the administration of the votes to say after the next election, and whoever sits where I sit today as leader of the House, and I sincerely hope it will be me and the colleagues that I have around me today and the party that we represent, that's the matter for the electorate, will have to reconstitute the Select Committee for the right time of the next Parliament. The Brexit is something that is going to have consequences over a considerable period of time, not just between now and April. So can I please give the honourable members of the idea that this is a race to the Article 50 letter? The Article 50 letter is almost, Mr. Speaker, the beginning of the action, not the end of it. And can I also remind honourable members that the Parliament that will trigger the Article 50 notice for which is the Parliament of which the Executive of which will trigger the Article 50 notice has not yet had its Select Committee on Brexit established. So I don't think we're doing so badly. Norman Salmon said something in the course of his intervention which I think I should correct in parliamentary terms. He said, speaking for those who represent the majority of opposition, I think in respect that is an incorrect way of phrasing his position in this parliament or the position of all those who sit on the ESG benches, if I can call them that. All members opposite are the Majesty's opposition. There may be an official opposition, and there may be others who are not an official opposition, but the Honourable Lady, sister sitting over there, sitting over here, and therefore is, as far as the government is concerned, a member of the opposition. And so, honourable members who speak not for her, speak for the official opposition, but it's not as if they are the only opposition in
and have said that Brexit represents an existential threat to the current economic model of Gibraltar. And it's important that we always insist on that, that this is an existential threat to the current economic model and not an existential threat to Gibraltar. I took great issue and great umbrage with one headline writer who took that and turned it into a headline, Brexit will destroy Gibraltar. As I said before, and I will say again, nothing will destroy Gibraltar. Nothing will destroy Gibraltar. It may be that we have to reposition parts of our economy. Of course we will. So will the United Kingdom. And so will large parts of the European Union, where some industries depend on the United Kingdom. Let me give honourable members one example. This year, Spain has published statistics which show it has had a record year in the number of tourists reaching Spain. The largest number of tourists have come from the United Kingdom. The second largest number of tourists from Germany. Of course, German and English or the UK citizens have the right of free movement today into Spain and are therefore able to holiday there without the need for visas, etc., etc. So, if you take a terminology which is falling into disrepute even as we speak, but a hard Brexit, because we all simply know what that means, a Brexit without any of the fundamental freedoms attached to it continuing, so a Brexit where there is no freedom of movement between the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe, also Spain, is an existential threat, and therefore also to the Spanish tourist industry. And the Spanish tourist industry is predatory, also as being the industry that has pulled Spain out of the recession. Now, does it mean that Brexit is an existential threat to Spain? But we need to understand that a lot of the cogs in the economy of the European Union and the United Kingdom depend on the exercise of the four freedoms that make up the European Union, and that those industries therefore now face potential difficulties and existential threats. Now, because the United Kingdom government recognises how relevant all of those areas are to Gibraltar, in particular, of course, access to the European market in financial services and freedom of movement, we are being fully involved in the process of the United Kingdom making decisions about how it represents the case for itself and for Gibraltar in the context of the negotiation. Now, I don't want to comment on things that are outside here, but telling Scotland that it will not be able to have a veto on Brexit is not to say that Scotland is not going to be fully involved in helping to shape what Brexit might look like in relation to Scotland. Telling Scotland that it's not going to be able to stay in the European Union in the context of what is also a negotiation between the United Kingdom, represented by Mrs. May, and the Scottish First Minister of the Scottish National Party, one of the mistaken ties that he represents, is also a part of the internal politics of the United Kingdom. But members of the group should also, in the same way they advise us not to hang our hat on those words, realize that in politics it's words that are important. And those words which have been extended to Gibraltar in the context of how we will influence, how the United Kingdom begins its negotiations, are not just words. They are, as honourable members have seen from some of the things we've said publicly, and as they will know from some of the things that we have told them, and not publicly, actually the way in which we are being treated. We are being fully involved in the context of shaping the negotiations as we go forward. But that is not to say, Mr. Speaker, that when Mrs. May sits at the table with the other 26 members of the European Union who are represented by the heads of state, that for the United Kingdom there will be Mrs. May, Mr. Colin Jones, Ms. Alan Phillips, Mr. Fabian Picardo for Gibraltar, Mrs. Sturgeon, and the other representatives as heads of government of the Crown Dependencies. There will be one person doing the negotiation. It's the potential area. But that is the position today. So when there are meetings of the council today, Gibraltar influences any aspect which relates to Gibraltar and it is relevant to the world system. Under the municipal environment, we've been asked for details of a negotiation that is ongoing in Brussels relating to environmental matters. We only hear of things when they go wrong. So when there is a disagreement and something comes out, you know, it may be that there has been a failure of a request of information here, and therefore that information is not provided to the UK, because they don't seek it, and the UK then negotiates something which the UK usually doesn't realise, in fact, it's also but Spain does, and that's what happened to the text. The last time that happened, and other members will recall, was in relation to the fight of Kidney Agenda, which happened, I think, in 2007, 2008. It's not happening now. The very strong relationship we have with the United Kingdom, I think, helps in that respect. The Constitution is very clear that we have to be involved, and the EU matters are not external relations matters, simply because they are EU matters. But if they are EU matters relating to areas which are not the special reserve matters which the government has responsibility for, then they are matters which Gibraltar drives. But if we didn't sit at the negotiating table with the other 27. And so I would counsel against suggesting that we are not being fully involved because of things that members, whatever it may be, in the politics of the United Kingdom, because we are very pleased to be very fully involved. That is not to say, Mr. Speaker, that either in the select committee, the same is going to wag the dog, nor in the context of the negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union. So, people who have garnered, let's say the 4,000 votes, are not going to determine what the executive, well, on average it's about 4,000 if we work it out, are not going to be able to do, are not going to be able to determine what the executive, which has been elected with an average of 10,000 votes, is going to determine. Because there isn't a government of national unity. There is a government led by the executive, which is going to continue to make decisions, but the select committee can be an important part of where we work with members opposite. And in the same way, Mr. Speaker, 30,000 people are not going to be determined to be down to 60 million people. But there is a political commitment that it is in the interest of the 30,000 people, it's not going to be disregarded, and we're going to be fully involved in negotiating the aspects that matter to us. Then we're doing the red terms in which the select committee has been established. Well, I think this is one of the longest motions establishing a select committee ever brought to this House. Now, select committees have a way in which they operate, and that's contained, that's dealt with in the standing orders and rules and in the practice of this House. It is a select committee has a passive role, therefore, Mr. Speaker, only if you are thinking that a select committee can actually be an instrument of the executive taking executive decisions and executive action, and you're disappointed because you're not. But there is no select committee that I have ever seen operating in this House or in any other House which is a part of the executive. A select committee is not a place from which you govern a nation. It's a place from which you debate how a nation is being governed, and you can make recommendations which may lead to a parliament seeking to do things in a particular way, which will then bind the executive. But it's not more than that. And in the context of where we are, Mr. Speaker, the way that the select committee has been used isn't as important as Brexit, like namely the select committee on the Constitution, because we need the select committee to be able to take a barometer of public opinion, consult with the public, to be able to use the select committee to consider that consultation process together, and to then represent together to the Parliament in so far as may be appropriate a strange view, of course, the honourable members of the committee agree on my minority report, on issues which the select committee thinks the Parliament should have a recommendation on. It's nothing else. And so therefore, in that context, it's far from passive. It's going to do the work that the select committee in the United Kingdom and in Scotland and everywhere else is going to do, and the work that the select committee of this House has traditionally done. And if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, as the honourable gentleman has repeated himself, it's what they propose. So, unless they propose the select committee, not knowing what it is that the select committee does, well, they're not getting anything more passive or more active than they propose. Mr. Speaker, the length of time between the establishment of between the publishing of the select committee motion and taking it, I don't think is extraordinary. This is the first opportunity for motions to be know the call. I don't know whether they do. I mean, I sometimes appear to impute to them corporate knowledge that they don't have, but the position of the DUP, as far as we have always understood it, is that they don't want parliamentary meetings in office. They could have had a parliamentary meeting in office, but their position is not to have parliamentary meetings in office. Honourable members, actually voted down because on that particular day they had a majority of one, a proposal to adjourn the parliament to August in 2012. And they said, well, we never had meetings of the parliament in August. So what was the reason? We didn't have a meeting in the parliament in August. Although, I cancelled probably my family home and continued working, I would have happily come to have a meeting in August with Sir Edward. And in September, we have been doing the work that we have to do. As honourable members will know, September is a very, very, September and October are very, very busy months. So they will learn from their time in Parliament, particularly of June, July, and September, October are examination months in government executive terms. And especially for anybody who wishes to occupy this chair, because there are the party conferences, etc., and there is, of course, the session in New York. Of the four committees, as honourable gentlemen will have seen. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, there is a need to continue with the executive action that is going to produce the results for Gibraltar on Brexit and other areas, which we have been pursuing, and I'm grateful that the other gentleman said it rightly, in the context of what they've seen publicly already, and some of which they will have also had comment on from us that are not publicly. Now, Mr. Speaker, in particular, honourable gentlemen will know that the past week has been very active indeed in respect of the sovereignty of Gibraltar, which is an issue that Brexit opens as far as some are concerned. In the Kingdom of Spain, the honourable gentleman introduced that aspect into the discussion, in my view, correctly, because this is one of the issues that we will be dealing with in the context of Brexit. That there was political unity in Gibraltar on the subject leading up to the referendum. All of the former chief ministers of Gibraltar, James Neal, the current chief minister, and saying to the general public, the big issue is that Spain is likely to want to exploit a potential Brexit for its own purposes, and therefore, tangentially, this is a vote about whether joint sovereignty should be put back on the table or not. And we're going to have seen that played out from the morning of the 24th. But with growing intensity in the past 72 hours since Tuesday afternoon in New York, and even today, a further interview by the current caretaker Foreign Minister of Spain in Addison newspaper, responding to a government press conference of yesterday at 5 o'clock. So, honourable gentlemen, I don't think that these things happen just when they pop up. There is a lot of build up to what eventually emerges, and a lot of leadership prepare to be able to respond in a strategic and tactical manner to some of the things that we are dealing with. And Mr. Speaker, I think it is important to speak on behalf of the whole House to say that on the subject of Brexit, if somebody thinks that the sovereignty of Gibraltar is somehow on the table for discussion and negotiation, what they will get from the Select Committee, whether it's passive or passive, from the executive, and I hope also, I have no doubt, from the opposition and the whole of it, represented by the seven members opposite, is a very clear statement that the voter will never be silent, whether in the context of Brexit negotiations or not in the context of Brexit negotiations. That never means never, that no means no, all the things that I have said in the last 72 hours have been saying. Since the 24th, and that nobody should begin to believe that any door opens on the issue of sovereignty, because, well, I've seen some suggestions that the issue is not that, the issue is the economy. Well, of course the issue is the economy, but there is no back door into sovereignty, either through Brexit or through the economy. Sovereignty, as far as the government of Gibraltar is concerned, and the government, is an issue which will never be on the table. And to have heard, as one has in the past 24 hours, that not just President Alessandro will get his hand from the left, but that he will raise the Spanish flag in the next 4 years, is really to see the diplomacy of a great kingdom, and greatly European kingdom like Spain are descending to thought, descending to utter thought, and nothing that we have heard in the past 72 hours is going to change the opinion of the Gibraltarians on the issue of the sovereignty of Gibraltar. And there is no argument that can be put to us because we are determined that the sovereignty of Gibraltar will continue to be entirely different. And as I said yesterday in the speaker, this is not about threat and it's not about benefit. This is about respect. The speaker, 60 years ago, the United Kingdom suggested to Spain, if you have an issue with the sovereignty of Gibraltar, to go to the European, to the International Court of Justice. Spain refused, and this is to see a political attempt to take over the Gibraltar sovereignty. Now, the members, we have heard what I told the United Nations in that respect. What we need to do, and to be united on, are to ensure that everything that we do in dealing with Brexit maintains that very clear position that Spain doesn't see an opportunity to somehow put her foot in the door. Indeed, the speaker, is it true that some of Gibraltar's best friends in the British Parliament said that actually one of the reasons they supported Brexit, contrary to our own reason to vote, was because they saw the European institutions and the 26 other member states getting their foot in the door of British sovereignty over the United Kingdom of the integration. And some of our friends said, therefore, you see, Spain has 127 that have put in already the sovereignty of Gibraltar. So those of us who did not support Brexit now have the comfort of at least taking the view that if those who did support Brexit were right, then we are kicking that Spanish toe, or 127 of the Spanish foot, out of the door with Brexit. So no matter how carefully you consider, you might find that Brexit is actually not an advantage towards Spanish sovereignty. It's actually a withdrawal of 127 of the Spanish sovereignty attained over Gibraltar in the lexicon of those who backed Brexit to the right side of the world in the sense of the United Kingdom, which we did not. So, Mr. Speaker, the reason that we will meet in camera is because we may need to discuss things which are sensitive in order to be able to get a common position on them, and we do not want those who wish to get not just 127 of their territory, but the whole of their addictions into our sovereignty. But that does not mean that we should not also meet in public when it is appropriate for us to do so, and call in the public, those members of the public who may wish to come in to give a statement. It is also true that you think of that the Select Committee, as I said, and the government cannot deal with this negotiation on the basis of giving a blow-by-blow account publicly of what is going on. Now, we can have such debate when the members wish in respect of transparency and death and all the rest of it. But no doubt this will continue because it appears with my skills in advocacy. Persuade 10,500 people, but they don't persuade 67. Right? But so be it. I'm quite happy to persuade 10,500 people and not 67. But in relation to this matter, this is not an issue of transparency. I mean, if we are going to simply look at what happens in the Westminster Parliament, the Prime Minister herself has said, and so has the Foreign Minister and Minister for Deputy, the Department of Relations and the President of the European Union, that they will not be giving a blow-by-blow account of negotiations. And that means, I think, negotiations inter-UK and extra-UK. It wouldn't make sense to do so. It wouldn't make sense to do so. But honourable members should know that we do intend to advise and even outwit the Select Committee of such aspects of the discussion and negotiation where we believe that they should, where we believe that they should be informed of any particular issue. And we will do that, Mr. Speaker, where the things that we are discussing with the United Kingdom are not things that we can say publicly, and they are things which honourable members should know. Okay? Now, I think it's important that I should complete this point before I go to another member. One of the things that the Deputy Minister was very clear on in the context of the discussion that we had in the days after Brexit is that, of course, many meetings that we hold with ministers and others outside of the border, in the United Kingdom in particular, deal with matters of government business at the same time as they deal with related sorts of matters of government business. And government business is something that has to be confidential in government to government, and it's not something that we can give honourable members a blow by blow account of anyway. But where there are areas where it is clear to us that we cannot say something publicly, but that the honourable members should be briefed, they will be. Select committee or no select committee. Right? It will be a conversation either between the deputy minister and the deputy leader of the opposition, or between myself and the leader of the opposition there, right? Although it's very difficult to connect, he's up in court, so it's easily for the deputy minister to get in touch with the deputy leader of the opposition. And I think we're able to get him to say
something. Yeah, I think we're able to get the fact that I am very big in the court, but never has the honourable gentleman attempted to contact me. I have not been there in the telephone in any part of history, or indeed local, whatever you have asked about the proceedings. Let me remind you, before I get to the point that I'm going to make, I make the decision as to who's deputy and who's not deputy within my rank. But thank you very much for thank you very much for appearing to endorse Mr. Hammond. He's probably very appreciative of it, but I make those decisions. I'll make an announcement, if I do, when and if I'm ready to do so. But Mr. Speaker, one of the issues that concerns me, one of the issues that concerns me about the Article 50, and hence from our side, the concern about time and whether we have made use of all the time available in order for us to impart to the honourable gentleman what are our concerns is that we've seen how the Prime Minister, Theresa May, has now said that the Article 50 notice is going to be triggered by the end of March. Could be earlier, but it necessarily has to be the end of March. But there's a date end of March to the Article 50. Now, the point at which, this is my understanding, this is what I would ask the Honourable Gentleman to comment on in large amounts in relation to it. My understanding of the position is that once the Article 50 notice is triggered, what there will then be is a list of issues that is produced on the United Kingdom side. The United Kingdom will say, look, these are the points that we would wish included within any deal. And then on the EU side, there is a list of points the EU would like to discuss and include within any deal. What then happens is that there is then an agreement, usually, we're in uncharted territory, but normally in these things, there would be consensus, and it's a point that the work the Honourable Gentleman knows, and perhaps the Honourable Gentleman therefore has considered this particular point, that's why I'm writing, that it would be dealt with by way of consensus about what are the issues, what are the parameters of this particular deal. Now, the danger for Gibraltar, as far as I can see, is that the Spanish government, through its lobbying, and it's already commenced its very, very hard lobbying some months ago, and send diplomats to every single EU country, manages to then persuade effectively the United Kingdom and EU to leave Gibraltar out. So what we are then faced with is a situation at a very early juncture where the issue of Gibraltar is excluded from that parameter and those issues for discussion. And I just wonder whether the Honourable Gentleman can comment in relation to that and whether he thinks that is a possibility and whether the government considers that, because that's something that does concern me and would of course then mean that the timetable in terms of for us is not 2 years from the 2 years from the exercise of the Article 50 notice, it's within a few months of the Article 50 notice that we would be faced with a considerable difficulty.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I
have been interested in some occasions. I've not been able to reach him. One of them may not recall, but that was on a number of occasions. He told me much later and has been unavailable. He can't speak to the Deputy Speaker. Look, I'm not saying there's anything wrong, that was normal. But he can't pretend that he's always there to pick up my phone. He can't come before a judge, and he can't pick up a phone in front of a judge. No, I don't phone him very often, Mr. Speaker, because we have diametrically opposed views about just about everything. And when we don't, and when we speak to have the same view about something, there's no better way of ensuring that we have a different view than for us to discuss it. So it's even better to remain of the same view absent discussion than to find a way to disagree. But look, maybe that's insane. And I didn't know that the Honourable Nathaniel was not the deputy leader of the opposition, otherwise I wouldn't have called him that. I sincerely thought that that was the case. Perhaps I also thought it wrong that Mr. Rafferty was the chairman of the party, but you know, I was simply reflecting what I thought had been the announcements that he had made. It was clear that he makes those decisions as he has told us today, and constitutionally empowered to make decisions in relation to constitutional proposals, but look, in my party, I'm slightly more constrained by a little thing called democracy. But never mind, I mean, it's a live issue in the Labour Party, how members of the shadow cabinet are going to be appointed. But anyway, never mind. It reminds me of that idea that one thing I'm going to have is something called annual general meetings that happen once every 3 or 4 years. Anyway. Leaving all those issues aside because I don't want to go into the party. Mr. Speaker, the Article 15 of the notice will set out some of the issues that the United Kingdom wants to deal with. It will be general, it won't be specific. It will be about the exit deal. It will not be about the new deal that the United Kingdom has with the European Union. This is an area where there is a large measure of disagreement between the Council and the Commission, and the Commission and the Council in the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom, the Commission, the Council, and the remaining 26 member states. Whether the exit deal is also the deal going forward, or whether there is an exit deal and then a negotiation of the deal going forward. And that is very likely to be the case. Very likely to be an exit deal first, and then a new trade deal between the United Kingdom and the European Union. And that is being repeated by Julian Armstrong, who is the Commissioner for International Trade, and it's also repeated by some of the relevant British ministries. And that has been said to be potentially very dangerous to the United Kingdom, dangerous also for Germany, dangerous for other EU nations, and it will be, of course, as dangerous for Gibraltar and for Spain. And navigating these issues is complex. Now, the Council leads the negotiation for the European Union. The Council acts either by consensus or qualified majority voting. Now, what is clear, Mr. Speaker, is that the Council, and therefore the President of the Council, who will represent the EU in its negotiations with the United Kingdom, will represent the position of the 26, not the position of the 27. So our work with the United Kingdom is not going to be reflected in what comes from the EU to the United Kingdom. That's our work with the EU, and the Honourable Gentleman will see that we have done a lot of work already, not just with the United Kingdom, but also with the EU. And we are continuing to do that work in partnership with the United Kingdom in respect of the recent lobbying campaign that we've seen from Fiona Roy in respect of other EU foreign ministers, that the Honourable Gentleman should not for one moment think it's just happening now. This is constant, and it doesn't just happen in respect of the European Union. It happens in Washington, it happens in New York, it happens everywhere we go or might go. During the time of the creation of the magnificent artificial reef just in the north of Gibraltar's territorial sea, the Spanish government was lobbying everywhere it had an embassy. Everywhere it had an embassy. And it said almost 200 of them. And we were counter-lobbying in 200 places where we had an embassy through the United Kingdom. So we did that in the European capital, of course, as well. But that doesn't mean that we will be able to influence what comes from the Council in the context of the negotiation.
of what? Out of what? Let's just say out of what? Of the negotiation. But look, the other thing we need to understand, I don't mean to be disappointed, but the other thing we need to understand, one of the issues here is whether the United Kingdom stays in the common customs union or not, the common market in goods, the single market in goods, right? We're out of it. We can't have a hard Brexit of the single market in goods because we're not in it. And it's gone very well for us, right? We are in the single market in services. So look, the United Kingdom may not be seeking access to the single market in services. It may be seeking a hard Brexit where there'll be nothing to negotiate. Other than potentially those areas of the United Kingdom that might wish to have access to the single market. Now, there is potentially only one part of the member state United Kingdom, because we are not part of the United Kingdom, but we are part of the member state United Kingdom for EU purposes under Article 355. And I don't think we should be having this discussion in public, but given the reason is, that would be seeking access to the single market and would be prepared to accept what the UK is told is the price of access to the single market. It's a freedom of liberty person. Northern Ireland can't do that. Scotland can't do that because they haven't got a border with the rest of England and Wales. But we can. Because we've got a border with England and Wales, and we want to have less of a border with the rest of Europe. But if the 26 come back to the United Kingdom and say, right, here's the price for access to the single market in goods. Here's the price for access to the single market in services, and all of that includes freedom of movement of people. And if the United Kingdom has already made a decision that it doesn't want access to the single market in goods, doesn't want access to the single market in services, and doesn't want access to the single market, to the freedom of movement of people, good luck, mother. I really think we're going to use that as a negotiation tool for the broker. And that is, he and I would not agree with the right position to take, I'm sure, for the United Kingdom. But it's increasingly looking likely, actually, disarms the person who thinks he's got a good negotiating position with the broker because it takes what he thinks are his creations out of his pocket. Completely. He's got nothing left to negotiate with. Where are we left? Look, where everybody in this community understands that we are left. We are left with a free market with the United Kingdom, that the honourable members know I said we are doing a lot of work on already. We are left with freedom of movement, not enshrined in the European treaty, because by leaving, we're accepting that that is gone. And the UK is leaving the European Union largely, political commentators will say, and the Prime Minister herself has said, because they don't want freedom of movement of people. And so the question is, do you have to have access to the fundamental freedom of movement of people in order to have an open frontier with people moving in one direction and the other? Or do you not need that? And the answer is, we don't need that. Because we had an open frontier before 1969, when neither Spain nor the United Kingdom were part of the European Union. So, Mr. Speaker, all of those things are the issues that are live. But this is not just about the Article 58, it's about what deal the United Kingdom seeks, and those are the issues that we are dealing with and seeking to address. And that is why, Mr. Speaker, part of the process has to be to work with the United Kingdom in the process of the exit deal as much as in the process of the new deal, if I can put it in that way. So, Mr. Speaker, the honourable gentleman when he was dealing with the issue of the fact that he had suggested that the Professor Beak demonstrated or convinced the suggestion that he had proposed a select committee, thinking that a select committee might do something else. I mean, a select committee were a place where the government and the opposition together won the objection. And I said to his honourable colleague, not to the deputy leader of the opposition, and he is not today, it is not the way the select committee is about. I mean, this is not a process that we proposed also, which he wrote about, where we were creating a committee for joint decisions to be taken. Some joint decisions will have to be taken there, but some issues which are appropriate for Parliament. But we have to continue to run the process of the executive negotiation on these issues. And this is not to create a joint sovereignty, of the decision-making process in respect of Brexit. So I was grateful that he got up and said what Mr. Hammond means, because almost as if he had to explain it, Mr. Hammond, and I thought Mr. Hammond was explaining to the relevant of the when he was in Gansky, it was very good. And I thought there was no need for him to, produced by his leader. I had perfectly understood what the Honourable Gentleman had said. And Mr. Speaker, if there may be areas where we do need a joint strategy, and although his advice, his assistance, and his counsel is not something we will often seek, on this issue we will often seek to inform him of things that we cannot inform the general public, and take his view on, and he said he would give us that view in good faith, so I think we hope that that is the case. I wouldn't expect anything else, but I'm grateful that given that he says it necessary to tell us he would give us his view in good faith, we will accept it in good faith. But the Honourable Lady doesn't often praise the government, I'm grateful that she did on this occasion for the work that we have done. This was a period in our history where we had to act and quickly to deal with a lot of the issues that were coming up. Honourable members of the senior have said, just in the last 72 hours, how aggressive, belligerent, and predatory Spain has become, for reasons which I'm clear relate more to Mr. Madrid's own very clear existential view of where he is going, and wanting to act quickly and get his claws into a joint committee negotiation quickly, and nothing to do with where Gibraltar is going, what risk Gibraltar may be at, and what the potential likelihood there is that Gibraltar might in some way be prepared to do anything to do with the joint sovereignty. And so, Mr. Speaker, I detect that there is support, would otherwise, for six on one side, and the Honourable Lady for this motion, for which I am grateful, and I commend the motion to her.
I now put the question in terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Honourable Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name as follows. This House notes that Section 73(1) of the Gibraltar Constitution Order defines public debt as all debt charges for which Gibraltar is liable. The House further notes that under the Public Finance Borrowing Powers Act, public debt is defined as any borrowing of money by the government. And this House thus endorses the practice established under the former GOP administration under both the 1969 and 2006 constitutions that borrowings by government owned and controlled companies are not considered and included in the measure of public debt. And Mr. Speaker, the origin of this motion is much like the origin of the earlier motion in respect of a motion which one of them Clinton has put, again, without contacting the government in an attempt to change the way that the Parliament interprets the public debt. Now, you would have thought that Mr. Clinton were of a view that this is something that he wanted to genuinely achieve. Again, he would have picked up the phone and said, look, maybe we'll make it to public finance. I want to change the way that public finance is dealt with. I think with my accounting qualification, I'm better able to determine what should or should not be public debt. And I suppose this wholesale change to the way in which the government works and the interpretation of Section 73(1) of the Constitution and the way that we interpret the public finance going by that. I'm not just speaking, by the way. I want to change the way that it was interpreted under the GOC, and I would like to restate the accounts of the voter for 1996 to 2011, and before then, before 1996, to which I would have said, well, don't worry, because there wasn't any government company borrowing before 1996 whatsoever. We had nothing to hide before 1996, neither did the government before 88, therefore, look, if you want to do this and you want to restate the accounts, or you want to restate the accounts of the European government, if we take the view that this is established and therefore it must be, therefore, you have a serious division in your ranks because you want to change the way that the GOC works for 16 successful unofficial elections. Elected for 15 years in government and accounted successfully against the electorate, although we didn't disagree, we didn't agree with much of what they did for this issue of the election. And he would also have met with my view that he was trying to take the vote in a direction that the principal auditor, who would have an accounting qualification, did not think it needs to go. And therefore, that we think that the public account of Gibraltar and the definition of public debt should continue to be as it was calculated in respect of the division between the government account and the government company account in the way that the GOC did between 1996 and 2011, and indeed in the way that the GOC defended in the 2011 general election, because they didn't propose to change it. Frankly, Mr. Speaker, it would have seemed, I think, suspicious for the Honourable Member, therefore, to have sought to persuade me to change that. But he might have then realised that he had made that call, that what he was going to do was going to hit the current GOC head on against the former GOC. And I haven't accepted the change of name. I'm not going to the new GOC, or the rare out like that. And there's no Monday Stonian text message in the morning, isn't there, telling them what to think and to be on message. But this appears to be a complete change in the position of the GOC, the current official opposition, in respect of the way in which that is calculated. Now, I'm sorry to have to raise this issue again, but in the context of a party that has considered, stated, and repeated that the trajectory of Sir Peter Cahorn, when he was Chief Minister of this House, is best referred to as that of the greatest libertarian of his or all time, you would have thought that something so fundamentally opposed to the way that the GOC did business between 1996 and 2011 would have been a source of huge embarrassment to them. But it may be, I feel, that the Honourable Gentleman does not have the benefit of a corporate memory that reminds him of these issues. Or it may be that he's going to go up and tell us that he thinks that things are not done right between 96 and 2011. But why would at least avail him of the defense that he's been no hypocrite? It would, of course, create a huge potential problem for the leader of the opposition, who sometimes, not always, likes to remind us that he was a member of the government between 2007 and 2011, when they won the election by a whisker of 400 votes, although Sir Peter then had the ability to remind me between 2011 and 2015 they won by half a whisker and won by 200 votes, without the need for any accounting qualification. Now, Mr. Speaker, as a result, when I see this motion, and I see the motion that the Honourable Member moves, I think that it is actually quite dangerous that we should be changing a constitutional interpretation and a legal interpretation based on the view of somebody who has been at the time of the news motion in the House of Representatives for 6 months. And that we should act contrary to the view of the people who spent 24 years in this House, 4-5 years in this House. Now, the GOC took a company structure established by the GOC, which had no borrowing in it, and turned it into a trading structure of government companies, which included a lot of borrowing in it. And in doing so, and establishing that practice, did so without changing the interpretations under the Section 73 of the Constitution or the Public Finance Foreign Act. So, what is it that has changed in our Constitution, or indeed in the Act, which changes the way in which we must interpret it for the state? the status quo. Absolutely nothing, Mr. Speaker. Because none of the changes that have been made to the Act, and there have been no changes made to the Constitution, change that. And indeed, what changed in 2006 under the new Constitution? Well, in relation to this matter, nothing, Mr. Speaker. Because none of the changes that we saw swept in after 2006 with the amendments to the General Interpretation and Services Act, with the other legal amendments, with the changes in practice, none of them meant that after 2006 we were accounting in a different way for the government companies than we were between 1996 and 2006 in that 10-year period when they created the borrowing of government companies and they accounted for the government companies in the same way that we do, except for one important difference that honourable members must not forget and will not be allowed to forget, Mr. Speaker. And it's an important point that the honourable members should make a note of. Government companies did not file accounts under the GSB. And they will file accounts under the GSB, except that it's sometimes difficult to file those accounts when you are reconstructing the accounts of the company between the period 96 and 2011. But we are closer to doing so and we will be able to give them the benefit of the publication of the accounts of the companies that they run and they brought into trading and they brought into debt in the context of company accounts, which will be public and they will be filed and subject to the company debt. But they didn't do any of that. Now, I know that we are now going to go into the territory of one of those debates where they don't want to look back. This is the don't look back matter. They'll get the Mandelsonian SMS now. This is the don't look back debate. This is not the history that we were the best government ever. This is the forget we were ever in government debate. Right? But because they were in government and because they behaved in a particular way, straddling old constitution and new constitution, 1969 constitution and 2006 constitution, and the borrowing powers act, they cannot, absent getting up, and saying it was done wrong by the GSB between 96 and 2011, and that includes Daniel Seaton, because he was a minister in that government between 2007 and 2011, they have absolutely no moral authority to take a motion that says the opposite of what the fund does. And so therefore it is absolutely essential that in order to have clarity in respect of how the accounts of the board are going to be handled going forward, that we continue by resolution of this House to affirm what has been the case until now and approve not just by Fabian Pigoli, but by Peter Caduana, successive financial secretary, Tim Bristow, appointed by the United Kingdom, Philip Darianan, appointed by the former Chief Minister of the One, and successive auditors. Because you see, Mr. Speaker, if this had been an improper practice, the auditor would have been the first one to point it out. Now, in the context of the debate that the Honourable Leader of the Division and I had, sometime in December 2014, I think it was the one involving the infamous close personal contact and arms going around each other's bodies at the end. I think we hugged each other at the end of that one, for reasons that both of us probably can't work out even now. But you had me first. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, suggested that what you voted needed was an auditor who audited accounts independently. I was delighted when he said this, because I was able to say, for goodness sake, where have you been operating? Gibraltar had an audit, because I think the transcript is available here on the general right. We have a principal auditor that audits the accounts of Gibraltar already. And Peter, that auditor would immediately have said that the practice that the GSB had started, and we had simply continued under the same financial secretary that we had in the picture, was contrary
Section 73 of the Constitution on the public finance to empower that.
It's wrong. So this motion deals with that attempt at change of interpretation, which would be contrary to the clear interpretation given between 96 and 2011, under the 69th Constitution, the 2006 Constitution, under the old Public Finance and Power Act, under the new Public Finance and Power Act, as amended by the DOP, and nothing has changed. And so, therefore, Mr. Speaker, I commend to the House that we continue the practice. I never thought I would say these words. I commend to the House that we continue the practice established by Sofita Cabrera and the GOP, and continued by Sofita Cabrera and Daniel Beaton when he was in government with him. I set out in this motion, and that we don't accept the opposite of the motion that the member opposite moves to suggest the contrary.
I now propose the question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. If any Honourable Member wish to contribute to the debate on the motion, the Honourable Roy Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, let's accept the senior deja vu. That one motion by Justice Captain Horton, that two motions by Justice have complete misfortune. But the answer, on the other hand, Mr. Speaker, I should be careful. We'd like to take a double check on our Chief Minister's motion. Well, not only are we hijacking my motion quite deliberately, but now he's not even bothering to change the wording of my motion. He just had copied 2/3 of my motion, and he changed the last paragraph. But of course, the Speaker is really sort of said, no, he's not lazy, but I looks lazy to me. Mr. Speaker, I don't propose to give a great speech on this motion, because frankly, I have my own prepared speech for the Chief Minister of the Right and the function. If I were to call the Chief Minister every time I propose to bring an idea, a motion, or question to the House, I might be rightly accused of wanting to subject to his whip. Do I have to go to number 6 every time I want something debated in this House? Perhaps it would be easier if I just cross the floor and join them on that side of the House. But obviously, I have no intention of doing that. I do really appreciate the speaking government, that I use the word, for accountants. And thankfully, accountants are now serving more in this House than they have ever had before. Whereas before, it would appear this is a citizen school for lawyers. And so, Mr. Speaker, the substance of my motion, I will debate when I come to my motion. And again, I have subject matter which I think I will attempt to persuade the members opposite as to merit my motion. Now, he did say at one point, well, Mr. Speaker, this has been the rule for years. Nothing has changed. What's changed? Well, I can think of two things that have changed, Mr. Speaker. One is credit finance, £400 million. And two, towards the capital assets, limited, £300 million. But, of course, the principal auditor cannot comment on these areas because they're not within his remit. And therefore, of course, the principal auditor has nothing to say on the matter because they're not within his remit. But, Mr. Speaker, my motion is exactly the point. They should be within his remit. He should be really reporting on these companies and reporting to Parliament. And he should be in his report. So I don't see what the Chief Minister finds the fault in my motion. Now, of course, I'm happy to keep on calling the Chief Minister every time I have an idea, noon, morning or night, but he may find more objectionable. In fact, as he said, I have 3 letters that I have written to him. One part of the budget, which he never responded to. One subsequent to the budget, which I'm still waiting for. And one which I am requesting that technical meeting on the 300 million, which I appreciate the Chief Minister in telling, and may not have time to respond to. I think, Mr. Speaker, I do not propose to debate with the Chief Minister at this point in time. I have my own views that are expressed in my own motion. And perhaps, I don't know how we can get around this, Mr. Speaker, in this idea of somehow wasting the House's time in debating different motions, but it may assist the House of the Chief Minister attempting to head up my own motion and debate the merits of the subject. And again, Mr. Speaker, I will be calling for a division. Thank you.
Is there any honourable member who should speak on the motion? The honourable member might be on. Yes, I'm on.
Mr. Speaker, given that I am in the privileged position to not contradict any stance or history of any party position, and that I have the benefit of representing from this chair what is truly in the best interest of this community, which is maximum transparency and accountability, and then, of course, taking into account this government's mantra of implementing a new dawn, where it is the government's duty to look forward and not backward, I oppose this government's motion to not incorporate or include borrowings by government-owned and control companies.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful to the Honourable Lady for the stance that she's taken. Of course, it's a stance that we couldn't have taken a different stance, because when she stood for the by-election in 2013 with the DOD and defending DOD policy, and indeed when she also stood in 2015, defending GOV policy, of which this issue looms very large, but particularly in 2013. One of the points that he made in the by-election, which is a point that is extremely important in this debate, and is the distinguishing feature of what was happening between 1996 and subsequent to 2008, 2009, is of course that what has happened in the world is that we have had Greece, and we have had the consequences of Greece. And indeed, if you look at the consequences of Greece and the effect that it had on the financial system, not only as a response to the effect that it had in the financial system, and the contagion and the depression that led not only in Europe but also worldwide, governments within Europe reacted. And indeed, the United Kingdom, not when we were during the time that we were in government, but actually subsequent to that, analysing what had happened subsequent to 2008 and between 2008 and 2011-12, what they did was, as indeed governments in other parts of Europe and the world, was that they changed the definition of public debt. And the United Kingdom in particular, yes, absolutely, the United Kingdom in particular, that had a policy of not including the debt of government-owned companies, of not including, for example, certain aspects of PFI arrangements within the calculation of public debt and how public debt was computed, then started to include, for the sake of transparency, because Greece led government to be more transparent, because part of the problem with Greece was that lack of transparency, it led to more transparency and the inclusion of the debt of government-owned companies as part of the computation of public debt. And that is what we fought the election last time round on the basis of those arguments. But we lost, absolutely. We lost the election. But the reality is that the situation then and now are markedly different. And of course, as my honourable friend Mr. Clinton also correctly points out, the situation then and the situation now is, in our view, materially and significantly different, Because what the government is seeking to do, what the government has sought to do since 2012, when it amended the Gibraltar Savings Bank Act in March of 2012, and in 2013 when it created Credit Finance Company Limited and decided to invest £400 million of savers' money into that particular company, is to have the bulk of its public debt off balance sheet, in other words, not directly the debt of the government, but the debt of government-owned companies. And what that has allowed the government to do is to effectively come to this house and to say, or to the public, and say, our public debt in gross terms is 400 and...
I am to that personally. I want to give some guidance for the rest of this motion and Mr. Clinton's motion as well. The motion is about definition of debt. It is not about the amount. Whether the public debt is 400 million or whether it's £1, it's got nothing to do with it. And therefore, I'm laying down a marker with the leader of the opposition, which I will carry over when anybody else takes part in the debate, including the two things that Reich has replied, and for Mr. Roy Clinton's motion. Because you see, the government and the opposition have for months been going at each other hammer and tongs in exchanges outside this parliament about the question of public debt and the amount involved. And what we are not going to do, if we want to bring this debate to the House, you are perfectly entitled to do so. But we cannot do that under a motion which has got nothing to do with the amount of public debt, but just has to do with the definition of debt. I want to make that abundantly clear, because the moment that honourable members begin to throw sums of money across the floor of the House, I will call them to account. I hope that is clear. Now, the Honourable Mr. Clinton, yes?
Mr. Speaker, I'm offering to your attention that, of course, my motion specifically directed a bringing in that encompasses into the definition of public debt. So I cannot stop mentioning them. So if you have a problem, you mention a number, but I will have to mention them, although I will exclude the number you say yes.
Okay.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, that is the second time that Mr. Speaker has interrupted with you, of course, and I
indeed the second time, and let me tell the leader of the opposition that if I have to interrupt him 10 times, or anybody else in this house, or anybody else, I will do so, because that is my job. That is what I have been appointed speaker for. And the moment that honourable members are not happy with that, all they have to do is to bring a motion of censure against me, and then I will be quite happy to go home, having done my duty to the best of my ability. I thought for months the leader of the opposition and I were getting on very much better since the last election. The moment that earlier today, I had to call his attention to a very small matter, he immediately challenged me. And now he's doing it again. If he wants to continue to do that, let me tell you that for as long as I am speaker, that it's only going to be one win. Unless he does bring a motion of censure against me, I'm successful. I would like to get on with him as we have been doing since the last election. And therefore, I'm giving general guidance, which I am doing now because I know that the moment that he sits down, the Chief Minister will stand up, and then the debate will become one about the level of public debt and not about the definition. And it can happen again later this afternoon under Mr. Roy Clinton's motion. That is what I am doing. I am laying a marker. I think I am very liberal. When honourable members are debating in the motion, I am very liberal and hardly ever call any of them to attention. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. But of course, Mr. Speaker, we live in a democracy. We live in a democracy. And this is the heart of our democracy. And I am as entitled to express my view on the heart of the democracy as Mr. Speaker is entitled to express his. And let me tell Mr. Speaker, he has got it hopelessly wrong. Twice he has got it hopelessly wrong. Hopelessly wrong, and I am entitled to express that view to this House and to Mr. Speaker. Because, Mr. Speaker, what we are debating is the definition of public debt. And the reason why we are debating that is because the government says the definition of public debt, the government debt, the debt that the government owes, and the current definition, they say, is £446 million gross. And what we are saying is, well, actually, you should be taking the debt of government-owned companies, and if you did, then it would take the debt of this community to over 1.1 million. How on earth am I expected to debate, Mr. Speaker? How can we debate that debt? By saying that if the government's definition is what is the issue, then the level of debt is a certain figure. If it is something else, it is another figure. But what I am doing is laying down a marker that I'm not going to allow a debate about the actual debt as seen by the government or as seen by the opposition. Now, of course, this is a democracy. But in this democracy, the honourable members have handed me this, the standing rules and orders. And it is for me to apply these rules, not for the leader of the opposition, not for the chief minister, not for Mr. Bossano, who has been here as long as I have, or anybody else. It is for me. And I thought, when I was appointed speaker last time, I would do it without fear or favor. I do it to the best of my ability. I am impartial. I do not belong to any political party. I ceased doing that many years ago. And in the intervening period, I have been totally party political. And therefore, I think I am entitled to say that I have a duty to apply the rules of this house as to the best of my ability and as I think fit.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and nobody is disputing whether Mr. Speaker is applying the rules impartially or not. What I'm saying is that it is wrong. You have applied the rules wrongly. And that your view on this particular, on this intervention, is wrong. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, it's easily tested that it's wrong. The Honourable Gentleman has said during the course of his speech, 3/4 of his speech talking about the practice under the DSD and talking about how the DSD needs to. Why does the Speaker please didn't mention a single figure once? Not once did he bring in any of the exchanges that honourable members have been having for months. Speaker. Okay, Mr. Speaker. I see that what Mr. Speaker finds objectionable is my mentioning the fact that the government brought the debt is $436 million, and if you took the debt, the government only comes into account, it's $1.1 million. Quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, I do think that Mr. Speaker, can I have the opportunity to speak? You don't seem to understand what I am telling you. You don't seem to understand. I said that I was laying a marker. I was issuing a warning that I didn't want those figures that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has been mentioning, I did not want those figures to become the subject of debate. I am laying down a marker in anticipation. That is all I am doing here, but we are taking it much further.
Well, Mr. Speaker. Okay, so Mr. Speaker is laying a marker for the House in general. Mr. Speaker, I would invite Mr. Speaker that maybe he's laying a marker each time around, but perhaps rather than interrupt members of the House in the middle of a speech to lay a marker, that perhaps one can wait until after the speech. May I say, Mr. Speaker, that the point is very simple. The point made by the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Clinton, is absolutely right. What has changed, apart from the fact that we had a Greece in 2008 and that countries have responded to that in terms of their additional transparency, is that what has happened over the last 5 years is that the government is increasingly borrowing off balance sheet. In other words, it is not borrowing directly itself,
in order so that that doesn't appear on the government account, that it is borrowing off balance sheet via the account of government owned companies, so that then it can come to this House. And I'm not going to mention any figures because I don't want to incur the wrath of Mr. Speaker, but in order to say to this House, there is X million owed by the government, and that is the end of the matter. And that, we believe, is fundamentally wrong, because it does not give an adequate or accurate picture, Mr. Speaker, of the indebtedness of this community. Because at the end of the day, if a government-owned company cannot repay, for example, the £300 million that is being borrowed, secured on a mortgage of fixed housing estate, if the government is going to have to pay, Mr. Speaker, if the government effectively, these are government-owned companies, and therefore what we are certainly saying is that whatever has happened in the past, let us be more transparent, Mr. Speaker. Let us be transparent with the people of Gibraltar. Let us be realistic about what the levels of public debt are by taking into account not only the direct debt of the government, but also the debt of government-owned companies. And there is, Mr. Speaker, we'll be glad to hear that I'm concluding, and is an additional, and I hope that I'm not swearing into territory that Mr. Speaker does not want me to swear into, but there is an additional reason, of course, why the situation is different even today than it was 7 months ago. We have had a Brexit. The responsibility now on all of us is to be more transparent about where we are as a community in relation to our public finances. Where we are as a community in terms of the borrowing of this community. And you cannot judge, Mr. Speaker, you cannot judge how the public finances of Gibraltar are performing by undertaking an awkward exercise and sticking your head in the sand about all that money, the 400 million. I apologize for mentioning 400 million, but the money in credit finance, and indeed, the 400 million in credit finance, and indeed, the figure that should not be named, the other figures in relation to the mortgage on the fixed housing estate. Because combined, Mr. Speaker, that means substantially more than what the government directly owes in debt. And that is really what divides us. We want to be more transparent and give a picture. They want to be less transparent and give a picture that is completely and utterly skewed.
We have a contributor to the debate. Calling the mover to reply.
Mr. Speaker, I want to start by saying that under the provisions of Section 50 and 51 of the standing orders and rules of this House, when you speak, you must be heard in silence, and that you have responsibility for order, and that those of us who represent the government in this side of the House entirely accept that. And given where the exchange has gone with the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition, and who I think should take a healthy dose of respect medicine, I want to thank you for your service in this House as a member of it between 1972 and 1992, and for your service as Speaker in this House since you were called upon to serve again. And I thank you in particular, Mr. Speaker, for every time that you have spoken out against me, for every time you have interrupted me, and for every time you have interrupted a member on this side, and you have felt it necessary to call us to order to
the advantage of what we on behalf of our community, all of us together, have asked you to do, and therefore I think it is important that you know that you enjoy the confidence of everyone who sits on this side of the house, and that you enjoy that confidence even when we disagree with you, because we know that you are making rulings based on your experience and your interpretation of the rules. Mr. Speaker, moving on now to the speeches we have heard from honourable members. But the honourable Mr. Clinton says that he feels there's a rule in having another motion hijacked. He said, well, Mr. Speaker, I feel there's a rule being called lazy twice in one day. Never happened to me before. I mean, of all the characterizations which are less than attractive of me, a laziness is not one that has often been put to me. The reason I have copied the first two paragraphs of his motion is to demonstrate, even in the context of my motion, that he is condemning that which his party was responsible for when it was in government, and his leader was responsible for as a minister when he was in government. This is not an exercise in laziness. This is an exercise in demonstration. A demonstration of how wrong his motion is. Now, Speaker, again, if he wants to change the way that the accounts of Gibraltar are determined and the interpretation given under a constitution and the Republic Finance Law and Powers Act, the least he should do is he really wants to succeed, and he's not trying to just create a show to try and pretend that he might somehow be now a new GSD that will do things in a different way, which is clearly all he is doing. Then you would call number six, not to be whipped, because I told him that I don't whip my own people. The last thing I would do is whip him. The Speaker, what he would do is determine whether his motion is likely to succeed or not. Not to seek permission, but that we work in a parliamentary democracy, and if he wants to get 10 votes, or if he wants to get 9 votes, so that I get 8, and he doesn't prosper, he should ask me whether I would back a motion in the particular, whether I should think of putting a motion in the same way. If he has many ideas, and he doesn't want to be starting at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I dare say the Speaker will raise him the public services an excellent service, there will be no one to pick up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not going to be giving him my mobile, given that he's a Vincent intending to call me at that hour, although he finds that despite being so lazy, I'm usually working at that time. But much is more important than whatever motion he might want to be setting up the Parliament for. Then he would know from me whether he stands any prospects of success, or whether all that's going to happen is he's going to put a motion to give a speech on to try and persuade people or something, which is fine. That can also be something that motion support, but the don't then result in changes in the way that things are calculated. Now, the government gentleman said that there are accountants here at last. Well, you know, they've been accountants here, and it's a bit of it at last or not, but there's been an economist here for 44 years, and that economist, by working with people, has been able to change the way that the growth of the economy is run, and actually put it on a much better footing. Not because I say so, I would say that wouldn't done, Mr. Speaker, as David Sherman, but even the greatest civilian of all time said it in his valedictory speech here. When he spoke in the last budget that he spoke in 2015, and in fact, Mr. McCann was not here to hear him say that he also owed Global Panel a huge debt of gratitude for the repositioning of the Gibraltar economy after the close in 1986 of the dockyard and the work that he had done thereafter, Mr. Speaker. So I don't think this is a finishing school for lawyers. It shouldn't be. Lawyers should come here ready and finished. Ready and finished, ready to do political work, to be architects, like accountants, like journalists, like mothers, like fathers of our future, of our society, because that's what we are as lawmakers. We're not here to look at the price of TV fixed and of brick bonds. We're here to become architects of the future of our community. And there is one element of the architecture of the way our community is run, which we accept. And if I refer to the honourable lady, going to go to transparency in the way that honourable members are taking it with a very great of respect. But the other one referred to Gibraltar capital assets having happened, and this is one of the reasons why he was able to look. He said, he's always wrong. Gibraltar capital assets haven't been announced at the time that he put his motion. He found out about Gibraltar capital assets because I told him. The community found out about the great secret of Gibraltar capital assets because I talked about it in my budget speech. And I informed the community of the structure of that. And I told them about the amounts involved. I told them the person who he alleges is trying to secretly avoid the company's account being talked about. I brought it here, Mr. Speaker. So it doesn't make any sense for him to say that he needs to bring the person for this purpose. Indeed, doesn't he know that we publish from Credit Finance Company Limited statements online every month? And doesn't he know, Mr. Speaker? Of course he does. Because when he makes his arguments, which in my respectful submission are nonsensical about what the level of debt is, he says to the general election campaign that he's going to take the amount there and take the full amount of 400 million, and we'll talk about later about those amounts as well. And he's going to increase the level of debt to 900 million, he said that during his election campaign, in order to ensure that what they say are the amounts involved are covered. That's what they say. Well, look at the figure. How can you say that you need this change in order to know what's going on in credit finance and GCA? He may want to say, as I no doubt he will in his motion and as he's indicated today, that he wants all of the companies to be under the scrutiny of the principal auditor. That's his position. But it's nonsensical to say that credit finance and GCA are the ones that, in particular, make that relevant and are relevant after the DSV. Because credit finance and GCA, which are the two he says we are responsible for, yes, we are, we created them, are the ones in which we have most information. Most information. But what information do we have about the accounts of the bus company which they created? Or any of the other companies that they created and operated as trading companies and was followed? And he says that the change in credit finance is his name. Well, it's a secret. It is utter nonsense. It's utter nonsense. And of course, the auditor didn't say anything about these accounts because they're not in his remit. Exactly, Mr. Speaker. They are not in his remit. And that is where the Honourable Mr. Clinton is entirely wrong. For a simple reason. Section 73 of the Constitution and the Public Finance and Borrowing Powers Act mean what they mean, not what I say they mean. And if the auditor thought that therefore they cover the company, he would say so. And he would ask for the account and he would put it in his report. It's not up to this Parliament to say Section 73 of the Constitution means this. Or the Borrowing Powers Act means that. Because neither the Chief Justice in our court or any other judge, nor the principal auditor, nor any other party that interprets our laws, ask the Chief Justice what it means. That's why we create laws and constitutions. They are objective standards that go out into the community and others interpret. And he is coming here to tell us what he says they must mean in the future. He is not saying amend it to say this. He says interpret it to say this. And so, it's not that these companies are not within the remit and can be brought within the remit of the auditor. But something we say here is that the Constitution and the law do not put them within the remit under the GSP, under the GSFP, under the independent member leading a party and forming government, or anybody else. That is the nonsense of the motion that he has brought. He has three letters waiting for his life. I said he had two. He will get his life because he was still unable to attend to them. But he has to understand that in the context of what I deal with this continuously with scientists, but he's not a priority. That doesn't mean he shouldn't approach him in writing to deal with him. I commend him an advanced called email, which now enables me to read correspondence wherever I am. It involves small devices or large devices, and so it's what people type, and uses the phone line. I don't know whether you've moved on from letters to email. The phone is essentially email, or you've been trying to find the city. I have the opportunity to reply when I'm an aircraft, etc. But I do commend that to him, and others will be able to learn where I tend to be able to reply quite quickly to queries which I have the answer when I receive an electronic communication, which is mobile. So he doesn't propose to deal with my motion plan. He will speak on his motion in respect of the things that he was going to, or he would have dealt with in response to my motion. Well, very well, Mr. Speaker, he's going to be strong in the debate. I'm quite happy to be confronted, Mr. Speaker, to do it in that way. But I can tell him now that if he continues to put motions, that I think on principle he will continue to receive motions from the government affirming practices even under the GSD, as he has in respect of this. Mr. Speaker, I cannot agree with the interpretation of Mrs. Sanyang in relation to transparency, because as I said to the issue that we are dealing with, in fact, the legal issue that Mr. Lee got up and demonstrated for me, the question that he said was the post-week issue and the water cap for access and credit finance center limited, but the information is out there. And they got it because I give it to them. So, can they at least please acknowledge in the context of what they are saying that this government is giving more information than any government in the history of Gibraltar in respect of the government companies, two of them in particular, Gibraltar Capital Assets and Credit Finance Company Limited. And the information that we can achieve in respect of Credit Finance Company Limited, the honourable leader of the opposition, who is often the one asking for it, knows that it is impossible for us to do, because it is who is credit finance lending to? How much have you lent to them? What is the interest rate you're charging? But it is nonsensical for him to ask that information, and he must not get away with using our inability to reply to that because of confidentiality of the borrower as an attempt to suggest that something is not transparent. The best alternative example is the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is a World Bank, which is owned primarily by the British taxpayer in the same way as credit finance is owned primarily by the government of Gibraltar, not being able to tell you what they're lending to whom. So the nonsense that we are believing is that is perpetuating by that argument, and it's normally to not fall for, and now if anybody else in the community, so he gets up and says, right, if you were in another parliament, Theresa, what is the, I've seen the accounts of the World Bank of Scotland, what is the amount of lending in Gibraltar, who has it been lent to, and how much is the interest? He's got exactly the same answer from Theresa May, but he gets the same debate. It may be a government-owned company, but I can't give you information because of covenants of confidentiality. But you have online a lot of information about Credit Finance Company Limited. And you have in your possession already a lot of information in relation to the Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited. And you've been invited to a meeting on that. But I'll tell you what you don't have. What you don't have and what you did not defend in the general election or in the by-election when you stood with the DOD, and what you have not sought is the information in relation to the companies that they established. Because they didn't even find the account. They didn't even comply with the law to file accounts. So a lot of the lady was finally not able to agree with her in respect of this amount of transparency. Because if you were at least to say in the context of the way she put her argument, look, I accept that you're giving more than they gave, but I would like you to give more. Look, they are. That is an argument which then I would use by saying, look, we invited to a meeting on one, and the information they're not giving on the other is the confidential information, right? Yeah. But it is different in my successful submission. To simply say that I believe in transparency to be more. Now, look, the honourable gentleman in the back and told us to answer. The other lady had spoken because she had no alternative than to defend the record that was defended at the general election, at the by election, in the position she put. I think he's trying to somehow cast the net wide enough that he is stuck with all of sort of at least there isn't a rising sound where the inventor can speak freely without a social baggage, and he's stuck with the excess luggage of 16 years of GOP government, which is really, if you give enough baggage, you're going to be affected by British Airways flight. But this is an issue that looms large at the general election. It looms large because credit finances have been created by the general election and was one of the central fears of what we were told was an incoming GOP return to government. We lost this thing. We lose, Mr. Speaker. We lost with an average less than half the vote. I mean, if you want transparency and figures, I mean, we're talking about over 10,000 and an average of about 4. People believe the government was right, therefore. And many reasons don't agree in particular because you said it was a central challenge of the thing. But it was a central challenge and we won. So you tell me that we won because of our design for the newcomer World Cup and the Rock. If it was a central challenge, then the people are with us on that issue. I mean, if you don't do a survey, do produce this issue, then I thought for one moment that we were going to do Travolta-like term on the ground. There are so many new terms in this political career. I thought we were in for a strictly come down to this style of thing on his clothes. Look, Mr. Speaker, it is nonsense to say that Greece is what changes everything. I mean, he must have spent hours, knowing as I do, how his brain functions. You must have spent hours trying to work out how to drive the joy of distinction between 2011 and everything that was done then being done right, and exactly the same thing being done thereafter, with more transparency and more information given out, and still not demonstrate what a political hypocrisy is to pretend that we can now do things differently. And we've got this. He needs to watch that movie again because he really was not able to sound persuasive in any material respect in any of the arguments that he made. The figures that he quoted, and in my view, Mr. Speaker, you rightly have tried to prevent us from having a debate on the level of public debt, I will only say this, are wrong. They've now spent quite a considerable period of time as you detected, trying to pretend that the net debt or the gross debt is more than £1.1 billion. It is utter nonsense. I have enough of a high regard for him as a professional, not as a politician, and I always try and divide the two. I have enough of a high regard for him as a professional that even he cannot, as a politician, believe that the numbers that he is given are true. But if I have to accept, that he therefore thinks that he can pull the wool over people's eyes and pretend, somehow persuade some people, that that is true. But we are not going to fall into a trap of being obstacles and allowing him to do that. We are going to challenge him every time he tries to pretend that that is the case, and we will demonstrate that that is not true. Because we would like to forget, Mr. Speaker, in the analysis that he is doing and does, the amount, it is about 200, let's not get into it, of the savings bank funds that they had when they were in government. Because when they do their calculations, they try to ignore all of those things. And the company debt that they had when they were in government. Or doesn't he remember the debate that we had about fitness to govern, Mr. Speaker, when I was leader of the opposition? £24 million in bonds in the savings bank. Mr. Speaker, the other government is saying the figure of £24 million in bonds in the savings bank. Okay. I'm delighted that he's given that figure. Given that we're going to have another debate on this subject later, where the figures may be more of an unbelievable issue than an imagination, I will leave it to them. But we're going to have a lot of fun with £24 million, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely right that the government should come to this House, not just to deal with the motion put by the Honourable Mr. Fielding, who will deal with later, but to actually put a positive motion, asserting the position that has been accepted for the past 21 years in the interpretation of the Constitution and the public finance foreign power, and continue to assert that that is the correct position to take. It is absolutely nonsense to pretend by motion to change the meaning of a principle of overriding enactments like a constitution, or to think that by motion one can change the meaning of a law. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, the government was not just not identifying a motion, the government was acting entirely properly in bringing a motion, affirming the interpretation, action, and accounting of this nation from 1996 onwards under its former Chief Minister, my predecessor, for whom I have a lot of respect, but I have very little regard for much of what he did in government, and every financial secretary and accountant general since, and to deprecate an attempt to do the opposite by somebody who's been in this parliament for months. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, really that there will be a division on this vote, I commend this motion to the House.
And now, put the question in the terms of the motion moved by the Chief Minister. You want the clerk to call a division?
Yes.
Very well.
It is offered by Mr. Clinton, but it is seconded by me.
Very well. P.J. Bhavan.
Aye.
J.J. Rasano. R.M. Clinton. J.E. Cortez. Yes. N.F. Costa.
Aye.
D.A. Susan. Nay. J.J. Garcia. Yes. I believe Mr. M.D. Hassan Naon.
Nay.
A.J. Isla. Aye. D.H. Vigili. Yes. S.E. Linares.
Yes.
L.S. Yamas.
Nay.
E.J. Phillips.
Nay.
F.R. Picardo.
Yes.
E.J. Haley.
Nay.
S.J. Sacramento. Motion is carried by 10 votes to 6, with one member being unavoidably absent. When we return this afternoon, it is the Honourable the Minister for Business who has two fairly routine motions. I propose to recess to 3:15.
I would take the proposal to the other.
The House will now recess to 3:15.